The $3.6 billion that Bank of America, in essence, gave to the Merrill Lynch employees in bonuses, he says he doesn't know where it went or who gave the authority. So now when they go to the Merrill Lynch CEO, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, John Thain, he says the same thing. Oh, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. No. Bank of America gave the bonus. And then Bank of America says, it wasn't us. Merrill Lynch gave the bonus. So nobody had any authority, but somehow $3.6 billion flew out of the door. The interests of these executives are not the interests of the banks. They don't really give a damn if Merrill Lynch exists.
This week in Radical History for the week starting March 9th.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
And this week in Radical History from March 9th, 1865, showing that the U.S. is just fine with multitasking, U.S. military forces land at Veracruz, Mexico, and Panama, all to protect American interest simultaneously. Also on March 9th, 1879, anarchist Carlos Tresca lives. Unlike some of the more famous anarchists of their times like Berkman and Goldman, Tresca was early about being leery of the communist Bolshevik takeover of Russia and fought hard against the fascist rise in Italy, until forced to leave for America. Italy would put pressure on the U.S. to deport Tresca back, and though the FBI would gather over 1,300 pages of information on Tresca, he is able to stay ahead of the game until gunned down most likely by a mafia person in 1943. Also on this date in 1892, Ida B. Wells, friend and neighbor Tom Most, is lynched, which would prompt her anti-lynching campaign, which is followed by the destruction of a printing press and her move from Memphis to New York. In response to the alarming increase of lynching of African Americans, she compiled and published in 1895 a statistical study of lynching called A Red Record. Wells Barnett was also an integral part of the early civil rights movement, participating as secretary of the National Afro-American Council that led to the formation of the NAACP. Ida B. Wells.
And on this day in 1945, a fleet of specially modified U.S. bomber planes embarked on a mission to firebomb civilian targets in Tokyo, Japan. The actual bombing began the following day as more than 2,000 tons of incendiary explosives were dropped on houses, shops, and buildings, killing between 80 and 130,000 non-combatant Japanese civilians in the largest firestorm ever recorded. The firebombing of Tokyo was a decisive factor in forcing the Japanese surrender, which was already imminent when the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on the civilian centers of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Historians argue today over whether either act was justified, but many Japanese and Americans alike regard both bombings as crimes against humanity for which the U.S. has never atoned. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 9th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lastly, from March 9th, 1969, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which featured controversial music acts such as The Beatles, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, The Doors, and blacklisted Pete Seeger, is canceled by CBS Television. This is in the wake of the controversy over the on-air censorship of guest star Joan Baez. CBS Television canceled the show after they let Joan Baez dedicate a song to her husband David, who is convicted of draft resistance against the Vietnam War. Week in Radical History for March 10th.
The Russian Revolution began on this day in 1917, or at least the seminal events that led to the overthrowing of the Russian monarch or czar, when women workers in textile factories in Petrograd walked off their jobs and marched in the streets demanding bread and provisions, which were in short supply on account of the Russian participation in World War I. Socialists, including the Bolshevik Party of one Vladimir Lenin, urged the broadening of the marchers' demands to include an end to the war and the replacement of the monarchy with a democratically elected form of government. Tsar Nicholas responded by ordering his generals to suppress the marches with violence. The marchers, in turn, became more determined and succeeded in ousting the Tsar, whereupon a provisional government was established that represented the Russian aristocracy. And on this day in 1970, the trial of 30 U.S. soldiers responsible for the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War commenced. The massacre, in which an Army battalion systematically raped, butchered, and burned between 300 and 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians under orders from Lieutenant Calley. Of the defendants, only Calley was convicted, himself of killing 22 civilians, a crime for which he served a total of 3 years in prison. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 10th.
This week in Radical History, from March 11th, 1833, U.S. invades Nicaragua to protect blank interests. Anyone? Anyone?
Bueller, Bueller, anyone, anyone, Bueller.
On this day, March 11th, in 1917, the British Army conquered the Mesopotamian capital city of Baghdad from the Turks, dealing a decisive blow to the Ottoman Empire. The Turks had ruled over the region with some degree of brutality, and although the British general Sir Frederick Stanley Maude, who commanded the British troops there, proclaimed on this day that the British had arrived, quote, not as conquerors but as liberators, unquote, the preceding period of British colonial rule was even bloodier. Within a few years, several nationalist revolts were suppressed and tens of thousands of citizens were killed. The British even used poison gas against entire villages during that period. In 2001, a group of leaders of the Zapatista Rebellion in southern Mexico arrived at the Zocalo, or Central Square, in Mexico City amid the triumphal cheers of more than 10,000 people, culminating the end of a 15-day march from Chiapas to call attention to the systematic denial of civil rights for the region's indigenous communities by the Mexican government. The Zapatistas had initially begun their rebellion as a protest over the North American Free Trade Agreement, a treaty with the United States, which has had a disastrous impact on Mexico's rural economies.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 12th in 1864, General Carleton, commander of the Department of New Mexico, wrote an insightful letter to a fellow general regarding the recent surrender of the Navajo people. The letter proclaimed, quote, they found it was their destiny, too, as it had been that of tribe after tribe, to give way to the insatiable progress of our race. They threw down their arms and have come to us with confidence in our magnanimity. Talk about a perfect example of white supremacy and sense of entitlement. And they teach us that manifest destiny was a noble concept. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
More bad news on March 12, 1992 in Guatemala. Efren Bamaca, husband of U.S. activist Jennifer Harvey, is seized by the military in the employ of the CIA. He is later tortured and killed. This week in Radical History for March 13th, only have two items, 1864. First contingent of 1,430 Navajo reach Fort Sumter, New Mexico, during the Long Walk of the Navajo, a 400-mile forced march in which thousands would die. Also in spring of 1932 in this date, hunger marches take place throughout the country, and bonus marchers are expelled from Washington, D.C. The bonus marchers were World War I vets denied their bonuses for fighting all those years earlier. The current military would rush the encampment of the World War I vets with bayonets and tanks, showing once again how disposable our vets are once they're all used up.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 14th in 1794, Eli Whitney patented the cotton gin. The cotton gin, a machine that quickly separated cotton from the seeds inside, greatly sped up cotton production and increased demand for the plant. As a result, the African slave trade in America, which had been losing popularity, saw a great resurgence and the slave population increased by millions. Although Whitney is given credit for the invention of the cotton gin, there is evidence that the true inventor was actually a slave. Slaves who were not even considered full human beings had no rights to patents. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on March 14, 1912, IWW workers, industrial workers of the world, agree to terms granting wage increases as 10,000 strikers gather and vote, successfully ending the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike. The strike was predicated on wage cuts and horrendous working conditions in Lawrence. Martial law had been declared by the city-owned big business. Workers were arrested, some sent to jail for a year. A young Syrian striker, John Ramey, was bayoneted to death and a pregnant woman beat so badly by police that she gave birth to a dead baby as the strike dragged on. But the workers refused to give in, and when the raises were won, the strikers insisted that the largest increase go to the lowest paid amongst them. This is also the end of this week's This Week in Radical History, which was produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio for the audio I borrowed and abused. So did you like the shorter version or do you like the longer lengths? Let me know what you think by contacting me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's one long run-on word and address, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Got to run. This may be the end, but as always and forever, I am yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
We'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We
slowly learning that fact.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and has continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Gerald Kaufman, the British lawmaker who famously compared Israel's actions in Gaza to those of the Nazis who murdered his grandmother, has died at the age of 86 after a long illness. Kaufman, a Labour Party member for a constituency in the northern English city of Manchester since 1970, was the oldest member of the Commons, the UK's elected lower house. It was undoubtedly because of Kaufman's Jewish background that his comments drew particular ire from Israel's surrogates, including the speech he gave in the House of Commons on January 2009, more than 2 weeks after Israel began its bloody assault on Gaza, known as Operation Cast Lead. That statement to Parliament by Gerald Kaufman has been featured on This Week in Palestine two or three times over the past several years because of its poignancy and because it is such an incredible example of speaking truth to power. We will play that statement one more time in memory of Gerald Kaufman. And while you listen to his statement delivered before Parliament on January 15, 2009, please imagine a member of our Congress having the courage to do the same.
Sir Gerald Kaufman.
Madam Deputy Speaker, I was brought up as an Orthodox Jew and a Zionist. On a shelf in our kitchen was a tin box of the Jewish National Fund, into which we put coins to help the pioneers building a Jewish presence in Palestine. I first went to Israel in 1961, and I've been there since more times than I can count. I had family in Israel, and I have friends in Israel. One of them fought in the wars of 1956, 1967 and 1973, and was wounded in two of them. The tie-clip which I'm wearing is made from a campaign decoration awarded to him, which he presented to me. I've known most of the prime ministers of Israel, starting with the founding prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. Golda Meir was my friend. So was Yigal Alon, the deputy prime minister. who as a general won the Negev for Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. My parents came to Britain as refugees from Poland. Most of their families were subsequently murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. My grandmother was ill in bed when the Nazis came to her hometown of Staszów. A German soldier shot her dead in her bed. Madam Deputy Speaker, my grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers in Gaza. The present Israeli government ruthlessly and cynically exploit the continuing guilt among Gentiles over the slaughter of Jews in the Holocaust as justification for their murder of Palestinians. The implication is that Jewish lives are precious, but the lives of Palestinians do not count. On Sky News a few days ago, the spokeswoman for the Israeli army, Major Leibovich, was asked about the Israeli killing of, at that time, 800 Palestinians. The total is now 1,000. She replied instantly, 500 of them were militants. That was the reply of a Nazi. I suppose the Jews fighting for their lives in the Warsaw ghetto could have been dismissed as militants. The Israeli Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, asserts that her government will have no dealings with Hamas because they're terrorists. Tzipi Livni's father was Eitan Livni, chief operations officer of the terrorist Irgun Svai Leumi, who organised the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, in which 91 victims were killed, including 4 Jews. Israel was born out of Jewish terrorism. Jewish terrorists hanged 2 British sergeants and booby-trapped their corpses. Irgun, together with the terrorist Stern Gang, massacred 254 Palestinians in 1948 in the village of Deir Yassin. Today, the present Israeli government indicate that they will be willing, in circumstances acceptable to them, to negotiate with the Palestinian President Abbas of Fatah. It's too late for that, Madam Deputy Speaker. They could have negotiated with Fatah's previous leader, Yasser Arafat, who was a friend of mine. Instead, they besieged him in a bunker in Ramallah, where I visited him. It's because of the failings of Fatah since Arafat's death that Hamas won the election, the Palestinian election in 2006. Hamas is a deeply nasty organisation, but it was democratically elected, and it is the only game in town. The boycotting of Hamas, including by our own government, has been a culpable error from which dreadful consequences have followed. The great Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban, with whom I campaigned for peace on many platforms, said, "You make peace by talking to your enemies." However many Palestinians the Israelis murder in Gaza, they cannot solve this existential problem by military means. Whenever and however the fighting ends, there will still be 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and 2.5 million more Palestinians in the West Bank, who are treated like dirt by the Israelis, with hundreds of roadblocks and with the ghastly denizens of the illegal Jewish settlements harassing them as well. The time will come, not so long from now, when they will outnumber the Jewish population in Israel. It's time for our government to make clear to the Israeli government that its conduct and policies are unacceptable, and to impose a total arms ban on Israel. It is time for peace, but real peace, not the solution by conquest, which is the Israelis' real goal, but which is impossible for them to achieve. They're not simply war criminals, they're fools.
That was Gerald Kaufman, a member of the British House of Commons since 1970, who recently died, addressing Parliament during the Israeli assault on Gaza in January of 2009. And now on to our feature presentation, which this week is a recording of a talk that Israeli attorney Gabby Lasky made to a group visiting the West Bank in Israel from the Boston area sponsored by the Grelta Foundation. Gabby Lasky is a human rights attorney who begins her presentation by introducing herself and talking about the cases she takes on behalf of both Palestinians and Israelis who are prosecuted for the roles they play in resisting the occupation.
Should I introduce myself? Okay. I'm sorry for the gap before. I understood differently, but here I am. My name is Gabby Lasky. I'm an attorney. I'm a human rights attorney. I have a legal firm. You will meet Mary Ramadi from my office later on today, I think. And I'm also, I represent most of the human rights defenders in Israel, whether they, and in Palestine, whether they would be Palestinian, Israelis, or international. Also, I represent in the military court, representing the Israeli civil court, all the human rights and social rights protesters and demonstrators, whether it be from the social protests, the Ethiopians, the Bedouins, the protesters against the gas
deal,
and okay, so human rights. We do mostly human rights, but mostly we do freedom of demonstration and freedom of speech. I'm also a councilwoman at the Tel Aviv municipality, where there I'm the chairwoman of the Gender Equality Committee, and I'm the mayor's advisor on sustainability and the urbanism. And I'm a merits, the merits, Anala, how do you say Anala?
Executive.
I'm the chairperson of merits executive. And I started as bar. I was the first merits student's chairwoman. Okay, so I'm really glad that you got to meet her and that we really do have very, very good generations after us. And, yeah. So let's start by telling you that I was born in Mexico and I came here because my family was Zionist. And secondly, I want to tell you that I believe in Tikkun Olam. When we have those two points there, I have to say that as after taking that into perspective, we have an enormous weight on our shoulders to make this society a society that we can be proud of. And that we can really be a society that is light unto others. Not because it is written that we are light, we are light. We are only light if we do good, if we do right, and it's in our possibility. But I think that we are in the midst of an era where things are turning dark. And it's very important to notice it and to talk about it and to act against it. And even though that all of my friends, including me, are wearing the lists of the right wing as being non-patriot, as being a bogdim, traitors, we are doing right because we are taking into consideration everybody's need, not our own. And that is what's lacking here. So I want to talk to you a little bit about democratic shrinking spaces in Israel. Civil society shrinking spaces, that this is what's really going on. Some of the things that are going on are by legislation, and some of them are just by plain incitement. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So I want to tell you the last, in the end, I will tell you that I'm an optimist. Okay, so everything that I'm going to say now is that I believe that we can change. And I take into consideration what Bar was saying, we really need your help. We really need your help. So let's start by presenting a little bit of what's going on. We have the most right-wing government that has ever been in Israel. There is no really any party that is a little bit, that's really center or even center-left that can a little bit put into the government a little bit of stance or try to change the way that or the direction of the government is going. Some people would say that in the beginning we thought that Kahlon, Kulano's party, could have taken that role, but certainly he's not been taking that role. Not so we can see that in all the activities that he has been done on, all the way that his party members have been voting in the past. And so there are the government is trying, although they're not saying it very openly, some of them are saying it, actually what they're trying to do is really trying to make a bigger Israel, trying to annex some of the territories, all of the territories, and they are doing everything in their capabilities, in their possibility, to shut up everybody that is against that path. So what are we seeing in the ground? I will give you several examples of what's going on. First, regarding legislation. This Knesset has passed the legislation that is called Chok HaAdacha. It means that members of Knesset themselves can kick out a member of Knesset from parliament. It doesn't mean differently from any other parliament or as the situation was before, that they can take their impunity, okay, from a member of Knesset. This Knesset has decided, they will decide who can be a member of Knesset, yes or no, going against popular vote. Yes. So this is really amazing, and it's passed by a majority of 62 members of parliament, including members of Kahlon's party. So this is first not understanding what a democracy is, and that there is that there are several different powers, and that the people are the ones that rule, and the members of parliament are only representatives of the people, but they are not supposed to be sworn. And that takes us to another point that is very dramatic. This is the first time that I can tell you that in Israel, you know, sometimes we have a left-wing government, sometimes we have a right-wing government, but there's always we keep all the time the rules of the game, and according to those rules, the one that loses can always present their ideas and ideologies in a free and openly basis, in a democratic way, and every 4 years, or in Israel is every 3 years or less, you can vote and change the government. But what they're doing now through legislation is they're changing the rules of the game. They're changing the rules in such a manner that we will not have a free flow of ideas, that we will not have a real democracy in that sense, that when it comes to vote, it won't be a possibility to vote for another party or for another ideology, because it's going to be bashed, it's going to be almost illegal to be member of it's going to be very difficult to be part of a group of people that are against the consensus ideology. Okay, so we were talking about the Chok HaAdacha, the law that allows you, the Knesset members, to kick out another member of Knesset. And we have all the laws regarding the NGOs. The law regarding NGOs, although you can say, well, it's, you know, it's the state has the right to regulate civil society in some manner, but what is happening is that they're regulating only NGOs that get their money from international bodies or countries, or part of their money comes from countries and not from private donors. This is a very different point, because all human rights organizations in Israel, would it be Betzelem, would it be a Shomrim Shtika, would it be the Association for Human Rights, for Civil Rights in Israel, they get funding from the EU, they get funding from different funds that have U.S. aid from funding that come from the from Swiss government, from Germany, from
Sweden,
from other countries, and most of the right wing NGOs are privately funded by private donors.
Sheldon
and the Australian, what's his name? And Moscovich, exactly.
He died.
But he probably left the fund somewhere that there. So and not only that, the law shows, it asks all NGOs to present every trimester their funds, how much money they have received from all of this, you know, from the U.S., from the EU. Like, Israel is not getting allowances from all, you know, from these countries as if they were our enemy or something like that. But if an NGO gets them, then it's, you know, it's a mess. But the regulator of NGOs can put a secrecy veil over donations, private donations. And the only organizations, the only NGOs that have had this secrecy veil over their donations are the right-wing organizations. Okay, so even though they're privately funded, we don't even know where that money is coming from. And so we see here that there is a very strong attack on human rights organizations, not only through funding, but also through, for example, our Minister of Education just decided that Shoblim Shtika, that the breaking the silence, will not be able to go to schools. I'm board member or legal advisor of Breaking the Silence and of Betzelem and of Gush Shalom and Machzom Watch and all these organizations. So we're all the time taking into consideration what next. For example,
they won't be allowed to go to school.
We send a representative of Breaking the Silence to talk to students.
Oh, okay, so not higher education.
Not higher education. No, school.
Presentations
in schools for kids that are going to go to the army and Breaking the Silence actually is an organization that's not talking about not going to the army. It's just showing about what are the consequences of the occupation and what soldiers are doing in the name of the state, but they're not calling for civil disobedience or anything like that, as some of the right-wing organizations are actually doing. So we have that kind of legislation all the time over our heads. We have the Minister of Justice, that she's talking, first of all, very openly, that the Supreme Court should not interfere with the Knesset legislation or with the government's legislation, as if there wasn't checks and balances in a regular democracy. So we're talking about the Minister of Justice that is openly attacking checks and balances. Okay? She actually wrote, we can say a good thing about her, she actually wrote a very long manifesto or article regarding the way she thinks, and she actually she said that the Supreme Court is not on the right track. She was talking about Ms. Smith, okay? That she has to take the reins from the Supreme Court to herself and to other ministers in order for them to do whatever they want to do without the interference of the Supreme Court. I want to I just want to tell you that the president of the Supreme Court, she actually comes from a right-wing family. Okay? Her husband, Yun Oh, was the secretary of Begin, and her son actually wanted to be elected in the primaries of the Likud party. But again, when we're talking about democracy and we're talking about the rules of the game, it's okay. It's okay that you have, it's as long as you play by the rules. And so now, again, what they're trying to do, as I said before, is they're changing the rules. As I'm probably sure that Gar talked about you, talked to you about the book of the...
Yes.
Okay, so that's another thing that they're trying to do. Not only through legislation, but through all the positions that they have, they're trying to change the way a democracy should work. And so, if we have a minister of education that, in the one hand, does not believe in a real democracy and is changing the civics book. And he is introducing a lexicon of words, of how a word should be thought of, and changing the meaning of words being taught to children in schools. When he decides who can present the topics in schools and who can't, based on their ideology, we have that they're introducing to our kids. You know, they are being shown only one side of reality all the time. Then we have the Ministry of Justice again, that she believes, you know, that the court shouldn't change or shouldn't interfere with the work of the ministers, and then we have our prime minister. That our prime minister decided that he wants to be the minister of
everything,
including the minister of communications. By being the minister of communications, he's in charge of all the TV channels and radio channels in Israel. And so. In that way, first of all, we know that he has an own privately owned newspaper that Sheldon has been giving him for several years. You're now in the midst of the police investigation regarding that. Actually, today Uri Blau in Haaretz newspaper just wrote that Sheldon or a Israel Hayom, the newspaper, has lost 730 million shekels in the newspaper, which actually means that this is not a business. When you open a private propaganda machine, it's not only a propaganda machine, but it's an illegal truma. A contribution to be.
Wow.
No kidding.
And how do we know that? There's another investigation against Bibi just yesterday and today. One is called 1000, the one that Milchen has been giving him cigars and red and pink champagne for his wife. But the other, 400 shekels of cigars and pink champagne. Milchen, for Bibi to talk to Kerry to give him a working visa in the state.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the investigation about.
How many shekels?
400,000.
In all cigars
and champagne. When I think about it, it's like house of cards. You know, if someone is, I will tell the writer, are you joking? You know, who would buy that story, you know? Come on. But every day we're hearing something new. So the other investigation against Bibi that is going on today is the 2000, the number 2000 investigation. That is, you know, in Israel there's a big newspaper called Yediot Ahronot. And now we have the Sheldon newspaper that is being given away freely. Okay, people don't even buy it. It's a free newspaper, okay? So... there is like hours that we haven't heard, but that is what has been written down, that there's hours of tapes saying that Bibi Anonymous is the chief editor and the owner of Yediota Ahronot have been talking about the deal that Bibi will make his newspaper not appear on Saturdays or make smaller
publications
and what Moses will give Bibi is that he will in return give him better coverage or positive coverage. Okay, so what we're seeing now is that if Bibi can actually handle how many printed copies of Israel Hayom are going to go out, and he can shrink, and he can decide if it's going to come out on Fridays or Saturdays, it means that he has a big say on it, on what happens with the newspaper. What is his position there? But then it means that in that we have the Ministry of Communications, that he's actually ruling over Free Press, and he's making deals, okay, for good publication. And what is happening as well is that in a democracy, we don't have only three branches of power. We have a fourth one. Right.
Yeah.
The fourth one is a free press.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the free press is not so free. Okay? So when our government goes out and says, we're the only democracy in the Middle East, we have to start challenging that, not in the sense that we don't want the best for Israel, but in the sense that we really want Israel to be a democracy. I don't have to tell you a lot about the fact that Israel cannot really be a democracy as long as we still have occupation. Okay? And as long as there is occupation, we cannot be a full-blown democracy. But we're talking about inside of Israel. And now what's happening inside of Israel is starting to be also non-democratic. The pendulum is going, if we're talking about if Israel is supposed to be a Jewish and democratic state, then we're going very much to the Jewish part, and we're leaving the democratic part untouched or not giving it attention enough. Okay. And if we only have a Jewish state, okay, this is not what our forefathers intended it to be. It is the home of the Jewish people, but it's not supposed to be a house for the Jews only. And that we can do everything in the name of Judaism. So we really, really have to be careful. If we talk now about what's going on regarding, if we're talking about shrinking democratic spaces, because of the influence of Judaism, because the influence of the National Religious Party, not the Orthodox, but the National Religious Party, they, which are becoming more Orthodox in their ways, we are again starting to talk about public spaces where women are not allowed in. I am a council member of Tel Aviv municipality. Just before Yom Kippur, they wanted to make a big slichot, service in Kikar Rabin, in the Rabin Square, but that no women were allowed on the party. No women were allowed to sing in Tel Aviv.
That's hard to believe.
2017. So we made a very, very big scandal and things like that. And in the end, they actually stopped. They were not allowed to do that. But it was a very strong, scary call to all of us. we have settler organizations that they understood that they have to settle in the heart. Okay? So now, instead of settling in the occupied territories in the West Bank, they are sending the
They're sending small groups
of national religious parties, settlers, to come and settle in the cities. We have that in Lodz, in mostly in the mixed cities where there's Jewish and Arab population. So we have that in Lodz. We're having that now in Jaffa.
Nazareth.
To create Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox enclaves.
They told us that they're doing it in Nazareth. Yeah. Yesterday, 30,000.
But it's not only ultra-Orthodox enclaves. It's ultra-Orthodox, nationalistic enclaves that are in favor of the annexation. And so we have in Jaffa, there's a new enclave like that. In the middle of Ajami, in the Arab neighborhood. Okay, you want to come to Jaffa? Okay, it's a free city. But they came to Ajami, okay, and while being there, if you read who the rabbi is, he is the brother of the rabbi from Silwan. Okay, so you know how they work in Silwan in East Jerusalem. You know, they get one building, and then after that, they make the lives of the people that are living there hard and terrible, and they start leaving, so they enter into another building, and so this is happening also in other cities, and they're trying to do that again. And while they're there, since they are being funded by the government, whether it be the Ministry of Agriculture, because Uri Ariel is the Minister of Agriculture, so wherever he is, he sends the funds, whether it be from the Ministry of Agriculture or from the Ministry of Education, whatever, they get a lot of funds, so they can enter all the matnasim, all the community centers and schools, and give, you know, lessons about Jewish holidays. They can teach children, they help them with their homework. Of course they can. They're being funded. So they are reaching, you know, they're reaching
into the periphery, really, into socially disadvantaged.
Exactly. And then... when we have a government that is inciting against everything that is not very right-wing, okay, because now everything, the Supreme Court it's a post-Zionist, they are left. Now the police, that they open an investigation against Bibi, they are left, they are post-Zionist. now all the Reform Jews, you know, that are... They're left wing. They're not, you know. So they're. If I tell you that, okay, I'm a human rights lawyer, and let's even say 10 years ago, my counterparts from the right wing, even they could tell me, you know, although I don't agree with your politics, I really appreciate what you do. I don't hear that anymore. We are being really,
marginalized.
We're being marginalized. And although I believe that we're the majority of Jews in the world, Jews that believe that we need to have, that we have to be the light to others, and that Israel is supposed to be based on equality and freedom, on human rights, and tikkun olam. We are the majority of Jews in the world. But in Israel, we're now marginalized. And in Israel, we're traitors. And by doing that, and because of Jews around the world have decided, you know, they want to stay by Israel, it is very difficult to criticize Israel. But as a father criticizes their son in order to teach them better, I believe is the duty of all of us.
to criticize our government, to tell them we can do better, that it can be different, that it has to be different, that it has to be different.
Sorry to interrupt, but wasn't there a couple years ago where Netanyahu essentially was trying to force a loyalty statement from Jews outside of Israel, in particular in the United States as it related to their loyalty to Israel?
I don't know about that. What I do know that there was a Lieberman was trying to push the loyalty bill that said that all Israelis have to vouch for loyalty to the country and for being Israel a Jewish state. It was really against the Arabs. It's the same as our Minister of Culture now says that cultural institution will not be funded if they talk against the state or if they criticize the state or they criticize soldiers. It's like, you know, Joseph Heller wouldn't have got funding from the state because he wrote a novel against, you know, that was criticizing the soldier, you know? Or Deer Hunter wouldn't have gotten funding.
I think Jeremiah would have been stoned. Isaiah for sure.
And actually, I always like to go back to the Act of Independence, which is an amazing piece of work. It's, you know, it's our forefathers, and Ben-Gurion especially. And if you haven't been to his house, it's in Ben-Gurion Street, actually, in Tel Aviv. It is very captivating. It's very important. Our Act of Independence has several parts. The first part, he talks about the history of the Jewish people, and what happened to us. Second, he talks about the making of Israel. Third, it's like the operative side. What kind of Israel are we going to have? And Ben-Gurion and our forefathers talk about that Israel has to be a state that bears in mind the teachings of the prophets regarding peace and equality, and that this state should be a state that is funded, that is equal for all Israelis, that those who were born here and not. He only says that it will be open for Jews all over the world, but that's the only place where there is a difference between a Jew and non-Jew in this land, in Israel. And he agrees, together with all of the signatures, that the partition of 1967, the UN partition, in 1948, that when we received the state in 1948 by the UN, this is the state we have. And the values that have to be part of our culture. And now our funding structure or piece of that gets us all together, the Act of Independence of Israel, just not to talk to the majority of people now. They would not accept some of the important things that are written there. And this is the important thing that this state was based upon. And again, since we have to go to my other meeting, I just want to bear with you and ask you, let's do everything in our capabilities to bring Israel back on track, to make Israel a light to other nations. And it's really possible. And it's okay to criticize, not because we want to criticize, but because we want to make things better. And remember that us in merits and us in the human rights world are being marginalized, and our lives are being very, very, very difficult and tremendous. And as me being a lawyer, every day I feel how even the rulings in court are changing, and how the best of our sons and daughters are being criminalized for protesting about what is wrong. And so I told you that I am an optimist. I really think that this can change. And I really think that this can be better. And I really think that in the end we can make people acknowledge that they have been taken to the wrong path. But we have to do it together, and we really need a lot of help for that. And we really need your support.
Thank you so much.
That was a presentation by Israeli human rights attorney Gabby Lasky. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later in the day, we realize that 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some, or to listen at any other time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive immediately, but remains there for only 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. This archive is developed and maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
One question remains, the constitutional issue that remains is whether this particular ban is rational at all, whether it survives rational basis. A second issue that might come up, and this relates to the standing question, is whether American citizens might have standing because of connections that they might have to people who don't have visas to come to the United States, whether their interests are also being harmed by this particular ban. And so then that raises the question of standing that is distinguishable from the standing question related to universities and states who believe that they have significant interest here as well in ensuring that people outside the United States, in particular from these six countries, should be able to enter the United States.
A conversation on the constitutional issues around President Donald Trump's new travel ban. We'll speak to Rose Cuisson Bilazor. She's a professor of law and Martin Luther King Jr. Hall research scholar at UC Davis School of Law. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The top Republican in the Senate is supporting the House bill to unravel the Affordable Care Act, arguing it can't be repaired and must be scrapped and replaced. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the legislation is backed by the one person who can sign it into law, President Donald Trump. Republican House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Greg Walden said the measure retains some of the protections of the existing federal law.
We are protecting those patients living with pre-existing conditions under our plan. We are not returning to the days of lifetime or annual limits. And we will continue to allow young adults to remain on their parents' policies until they reach the age of 26. And we will keep our promise to not pull the rug out from anyone, including those on Medicaid.
Despite that promise on Medicaid, the measure would repeal the Medicaid expansion by capping overall federal payments. It would replace the existing subsidies to help people buy coverage to a plan that gives people tax credits of $2,000 to $4,000 a year. Democrat Joe Courtney of Connecticut derided that aspect of the plan.
What this bill does is just basically decapitates the Medicaid expansion. So about 11 million Americans are going to have their health care coverage threatened. And they also convert the subsidies from an income-based system to an age-rated one, which means that basically a well-to-do person gets the same tax credit that a poor person or a single parent has. A conservative economist, Avik Roe, just a few minutes ago issued a statement saying, expanding subsidies for high earners while cutting health coverage for the working poor sounds like a caricature of mustache-twirling, top-hatted Republican fat cats. Again, you cannot imagine a more Robin Hood in reverse.
The plan also faces opposition from some Republicans who call it Obamacare light and oppose the idea of tax credits, calling those entitlements. WikiLeaks has released 8,000 documents said to have been taken from the CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence. Experts say they appear to be legitimate and the release is certain to shake the CIA. If they are legitimate, the dump will represent yet another catastrophic breach for the U.S. intelligence community at the hands of WikiLeaks. The documents cover a range of topics, including what appears to be a discussion about how to compromise smart TVs and turn them into improvised surveillance devices. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson compared slavery to immigration. Carson made the remark while talking about the work ethic and dreams of immigrants who came to the U.S. through Ellis Island in his first speech at HUD.
That's what America is about, a land of dreams and opportunity. There were other immigrants who came here in the bottom of slave ships, worked even longer, even harder for less. But they, too, had a dream that one day their sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, great-grandsons, great-granddaughters might pursue prosperity and happiness in this land.
Carson's remarks were denounced and ridiculed on Twitter. One tweet said, quote, Ben Carson referred to slaves as immigrants who came here in slave ships, so he must think Jewish people were in summer camp in Auschwitz. Gold Star father Khizr Khan has canceled a trip to Canada after he says he was told his freedom to travel abroad is under review by federal officials. Khan, who's a naturalized U.S. citizen from Pakistan, said he doesn't know why. He was supposed to speak on, quote, what we can do about the appalling turn of events in Washington so we don't all end up sacrificing everything. Khan came to public attention when he addressed the Democratic National Convention and criticized then-candidate Donald Trump's proposal for a temporary ban on Muslims entering the U.S. Khan's son died fighting in Iraq in 2004. Trump fired back with an attack at Khan, claiming his wife hadn't spoken during her husband's appearance because she wasn't allowed to, implying that as a Muslim woman, she was required to be subservient. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has started an emergency visit to Somalia to focus on that country's famine crisis. Guterres urged the international community to act immediately and warned that people are dying.
There is a chance to avoid the worst. There is a chance to avoid in Somalia a situation similar like the one we had in 2011. There is a plan of action. There is capacity on the ground. But we need massive support from the international community to avoid the repetition of the tragic events of 2011.
Somalia is part of a massive $4 billion aid appeal launched last month for four nations suffering from conflict and hunger. The others are Nigeria, Yemen, and South Sudan, where famine already has been declared. I'm Eileen Alfandari. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the constitutional issues around President Donald Trump's new temporary travel ban for people from six predominantly Muslim nations. The nations include Iran, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. Not included in this list, that was first in last month's travel ban that has been stalled by the courts, is Iraq. This new executive order will also put a 120 day ban on all refugees. So that will be in place starting the next couple of weeks for about 4 months. And then after that, it will cut the number in half, the amount of refugees that the United States accepts every year. So we have been accepting around 110,000 per year. Now we will only be accepting 50,000 refugees per year. Well, I spoke about all of this with Rose Cuisson Villazar. She is a professor of law and Martin Luther King Jr. Hall research scholar at UC Davis School of Law. And I spoke to her earlier this morning. Rose Cuisson Villazor, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you very much for having me.
First, your reaction. It's been called the travel ban 2.0. Your reaction to what you've learned about it.
Well, it is. It's interesting that the way that the ban was issued by this administration in response to the litigation and the way that the courts have put a halt on the first executive order. And so it strikes me in reading the new the travel ban 2.0 that the administration was doing its best to try to address the constitutional concerns that were present in the first executive order.
Do you think they were able to do that?
Well, this travel ban is definitely will be more difficult to challenge. Because it removed many of the elements that made it look as if it's a Muslim ban. So in particular, it no longer includes a provision that gave a preference for minorities in a
religious minorities.
Minorities in a majority-dominated country that is primarily Muslim. And so, and then of course, this does not have, it also is not surrounded by some of the discussions regarding whether Giuliani was involved in trying to put together a Muslim ban. And so the fact that this ban 2.0 does not include that element, it does remove that part of it. But still, the six countries, the majority religion there is still Muslim. And so at least outside the United States, it would still be viewed as a Muslim ban.
The ACLU and several Democrats have criticized this executive order, claiming that it's a thinly veiled or thinly disguised Muslim ban. Do you see any credence in that?
I do, because of what I had mentioned, and that it removed certain languages that made it much more susceptible to a challenge that this is a Muslim ban. But at the same time, we can see that this ban is still a response to challenges from the first executive order that was really widely seen as directed at Muslim refugees and Muslim immigrants. And so the fact that this new ban no longer includes some language, and from a broader perspective, it could still be seen as part of that overall desire by the government to root out, to exclude Muslim immigrants and refugees from the United States.
Yeah, it might be seen that way by you or I. Can the court see it that way? Is that within their purview? Do they have that ability to interpret it that way, or do they just have to look at exactly what does this executive order say?
The question, that's more of a complex question, because the question is either, do we only look at the words of the executive order, and based on the reading this executive order as it stands right now, it certainly doesn't have that same kind of language that might suggest animus against Muslims that the first executive order did. So a court would say, in looking at this, is there anything in the words of the executive order to suggest that this is an anti-Muslim ban? Or should the court look at the circumstances surrounding the issuance of this executive order? And so only a court would decide based on those different factors what approach it should take.
The White House and Donald Trump also put out a petition for people to sign. It's separate from the executive order, but it's for people to express their support of this executive order. Some people have pointed that the language that he put in this petition included that this was meant to combat, quote-unquote, radical Islamic terrorism. Is that something that could be used in court?
I think so. Well, I'm not sure. In court, that's a different question, because that the constitutionality of a law or an executive order always starts first with the language of the law. But a court cannot be cannot ignore all these other circumstances that are tied to the issuance of the passage of a law or the issuance of an executive order. So something like that might suggest to a court that despite the what might seem to be neutral language of the executive order, there are still circumstances that make this suspicious, that might suggest that there's still animus being animus towards Muslim immigrants and refugees.
Again, we are speaking to Rose Quizon Villazor, professor of law and Martin Luther King Jr. Hall research scholar at UC Davis School of Law. We are talking about Donald Trump's new executive order concerning a travel ban now from six nations. Any legal issues, Rose Villazor, concerning the refugee aspect of this? It seems like that gets overshadowed a little bit with a lot of the coverage, but the fact that now refugees will be barred from coming to the United States for 120 days, and that the number of refugees at the United States is going to cut in half the number that the country accepts every year.
It is really worrisome that the number has been reduced and that for 120 days, refugees won't be able to enter at all. The executive order does include some kind of a case-by-case waiver that would allow the government to still determine whether to allow some refugees, including those from the six countries, whether they can still enter. But this is really worrisome because there are millions of refugees throughout the world, and we have an obligation to accept refugees.
A legal obligation?
We do have a legal obligation under international law to accept refugees, and 50,000 is all that we are required under the law to accept.
So that's what they reduced it to the bare minimum.
To the bare minimum. But as you pointed out, this is a significant reduction from what President Obama's administration has done.
And this was 100,000?
Over 110,000.
Okay, so if they reduce it to just 50,000, it sounds like that, though, it has the authority to be able to do that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But, I mean, in the broader scheme of things, we're talking about refugees, people who are fighting, who might be subject to torture, to persecution, death. And we cannot turn away from our neighbors who are seeking help from the United States. And the fact that the administration has done this under the purview of reviewing our policies to avoid terrorism is really worrisome because there is no strong connection. The executive order cites some instances in which there are refugees or people who entered here as refugees and later on were then convicted of certain terrorism grounds. But there are many other conflicts or situations we've had here in the United States that were not caused by terrorists, I mean, that were not caused by immigrants who came to the United States. And so it strikes me that this particular executive order really lacks the rational basis for coming up with an exclusion, both for refugees, but also for the immigrants from these six countries.
Well, looking at immigrants from these six countries, again, Iran, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Syria, and Yemen, Iraq is no longer on that list, so it's just six countries now. As you mentioned, and many have argued, that there really have been no terrorist attacks from people from these countries here in the United States. In fact, most terrorist attacks that happen in the United States are from people who are here already and who are legally here, not just straight out citizens. So with that in mind, is that something that the court can consider, or is that perfectly entirely in the purview of the executive branch's ability to determine what nation and people from what nation may pose a threat to this country?
Oh, absolutely. This is still, so when this executive order is challenged, one of the legal arguments that can be made against it is that it lacks rational basis. So it's a form of exclusion, it's a form of discrimination based on these, on national origin. Mm. And in order to survive that, because this would still, it would be, this is immigration law, at minimum, the argument could be made that this lacks rational basis. It doesn't, if the goal here is to prevent terrorism, the administration has yet to provide sufficient information, sufficient evidence to suggest, to prove that that this particular type of exclusion of these six countries will, is rational, given that we don't have sufficient evidence, of terrorism committed, terrorist acts committed by nationals of these countries here in the United States.
Yeah, well, remember with the first travel ban, the White House claimed, and people that supported the ban claimed that this is in the purview of the executive branch, in other words, the White House and the presidency, who has the sole authority to be able to make these type of decisions based on the intelligence, that the courts actually don't have access to all the intelligence. Is this something that's still, is this still a question about how much the courts can take this in? And maybe this is something that will, the courts will even have to take on itself about what executive power when it comes to these type of decisions on determining who can and who cannot come into the country?
Well, this is not the first time that an administration has claimed that they that any kind of intelligence information they have regarding terrorism or security measures that need to be undertaken for the protection of the United States, that those types of evidence should not be reviewed at all by courts. And this is something that has happened. That argument has been done and has been upheld in different cases historically. And so it is important to highlight that there is, that the executive branch does have significant powers with respect to protecting the national security of the United States. On the other hand, the judiciary branch also retains its own independent ability to question the legitimacy of executive actions. And so what we're seeing here, what we would see here ultimately through litigation is this tension between the executive branch and the judiciary branch's ability to put a check on the executive branch's desire to issue its executive power to administer and regulate immigration and terrorism.
Because this new ban does not include green card holders or current visa holders, there's an argument that there's no one who actually has standing to be able to challenge this ban in our courts.
Well, certainly, I've heard that argument as well, but if you recall from the Ninth Circuit's opinion that put a halt on the first executive order, there the court held that states had standing, in particular because certain universities had the interest in ensuring that there are the prospective students, prospective scholars and visitors would be able to come to the United States. And so the new ban right now does not apply, as you said, to legal permanent residents, to those already with visas in January 27th, but then also up until March 16th, which would be the effective date of this ban. But then for those who don't have any visas yet to enter the United States at that time, past March 16th, then the suspension, those individuals, if they don't have visas, won't be able to enter. So then the question becomes, might states still have standing? And so long as a university, for example, would be able to say that their interests are harmed because they are unable to then attract visitors and students to the United States, that's an articulation of the kind of interest that one might say would have standing.
And that's what we saw with the first travel ban and the challenge there. The state of Washington had standing to challenge that. And finally, what are the major constitutional issues, do you think, with this new travel ban that was announced yesterday? Could you see some type of precedent one way or another on constitutional issues being set through all this?
One question remains, the constitutional issue that remains is whether this particular ban is rational at all, whether it survives rational basis. A second issue that might come up, and this relates to the standing question, is whether American citizens might have standing because of connections that they might have to people who don't have visas to come to the United States, whether their interests are also being harmed by this particular ban. And so then that raises the question of standing that might, that is distinguishable from the standing question related to universities and states who believe that they have significant interest here as well in ensuring that people outside the United States, in particular from these six countries, should be able to enter the United States. Those are the key issues that I see here. The executive order removed certain elements that made it susceptible to being challenged in the when it issued its first order. And so it'll be interesting to see exactly how this particular who will be bringing these who would be challenging this particular ban, what courts will be listening and hearing the cases, and also what would happen to the former executive order.
Yes, interesting indeed. Rose Cuisson Villazor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Rose Cuisson Villazor is a professor of law and Martin Luther King Jr. Hall Research Scholar at UC Davis School of Law. Enjoy listening to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Chesrich. Found that conversation interesting, including especially about the reasonable standard and how the courts may weigh in on that. So that these are all going to be things we know that challenges are coming to this new executive order for a travel ban. My friends, we're going to do something a little bit different today as KPFA is now in its final few days, really, of its winter 2017 fund drive. And I want to tell you where we are overall towards our goal. We came into this drive with a $610,000 goal. That is not an arbitrary number, but a number that is necessary for us to be able to raise in order to keep this radio station fully operating, in order to continue to bring you this radio program. Now, two-thirds of the way through this drive, now we're beyond two-thirds of this way through the drive, I have been able to bring you mostly the regular programming during this time, and that has been very exciting. But I do have to tell you, in these final few days here, we have not made our goal. In fact, we've been coming pretty far from our goal, what has put us behind on this program, Letters in Politics. And so today I want to see if we're able to pick that up. And the way that I want to do it is to promote Pacifica Radio and KPFA in itself and its history and everything that this radio station has been a part of and has recorded ever since its beginning in 1949. Truly, since 1949, KPFA has had its microphones recording speeches and voices and rallies and putting together documentaries explaining the time, and also for art and literature. I mean, just so much, really, getting the beauty, making radio beautiful again, I think, is something that KPFA has always been one of our overall goals, I guess, to do. So our goal is $610,000. That means we have another $185,000 that we have to raise by the end of this week if we're going to be able to keep things around here where they are and operational. So today I want to try to pick up our average for this this hour. And again, by celebrating, and what we're going to be offering today is from ourselves. It's the Pacifica Radio Archives 200 Voices, more than 200 people that are featured in a USB drive that accumulates to 1,350 hours of material. And it ranges from people like Huey Newton and Angela Davis, Stokely Carmichael, to Paul Robeson, to Gore Vidal, to Noam Chomsky. And it's just really incredible collection of speakers: Fidel Castro, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Michio Kaku, Alan Watts, philosophy, politics. It's just amazing. And literature. And that's what we want to feature today. 1984, written by George Orwell, published in 1994, has become once again a best-selling book. And why? Well, it's because there, I guess, are eternal truths within 1984 that speak to us again and again and again. This isn't the first time since it was published that it was a best-selling, that's been on the best-selling list. In fact, 2013, and when we started getting the Edward Snowden documents released, 1984 shot to the top again. Well, it's there again. And one of the great things throughout our history at KPFA is every now and then we get together and we do a reading of a book. And we did that back all the way back in 1975 at our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles. And it was read on air by Charles Morgan. And I have to argue, and I will tell you, that this is the best reading of 1984 I've ever heard. I've tried to get audiobooks from, you know, iTunes or Audible.com. I'm an audiobook guy. No book. I've always been disappointed by the narration. And narration's really important. And no book I've ever heard, actual official audiobook of 1984, satisfied me. The only one that ever has is this recording that KPFK did in Los Angeles. So I'm very happy this hour to bring you some of that. Again, this is 1984 by George Orwell, read by Charles Morgan.
The Ministry of Truth, many true in Newspeak, was startlingly different from any other object in sight. It was an enormous pyramidal structure of glittering white concrete, soaring up terrace after terrace, 300 meters into the air. From where Winston stood, it was just possible to read, picked out on its white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. The Ministry of Truth contained, it was said, 3,000 rooms above ground level and corresponding ramifications below. Scattered about London, there were just three other buildings of similar appearance and size. And so completely did they dwarf the surrounding architecture that from the roof of Victory Mansions you could see all four of them simultaneously. They were the homes of the four ministries between which the entire apparatus of government was divided. The Ministry of Truth, which concerned itself with news, entertainment, education, and the fine arts. The Ministry of Peace, which concerned itself with war. The Ministry of Love, which maintained law and order. And the Ministry of Plenty, which was responsible for economic affairs. Their names in Newspeak, Many True, Many Pax, Many Love, and Many Plenty. The Ministry of Love was the really frightening one. There were no windows in it at all. Winston had never been inside the Ministry of Love, nor within half a kilometer of it. It was a place impossible to enter except on official business, and then only by penetrating through a maze of barbed wire entanglements, steel doors, and hidden machine gun nests. And even the streets leading up to its outer barriers were roamed by gorilla-faced guards in black uniforms, armed with jointed truncheons. The thing that he was about to do was to open a diary. Now, this was not illegal. Nothing was illegal since there were no longer any laws. But if detected, it was reasonably certain that it would be punished by death or at least by 25 years in a forced labor camp. Winston fitted a nib into the pen holder and sucked it to get the grease off. The pen was an archaic instrument, seldom used even for signatures, and he had procured one furtively and with some difficulty simply because of a feeling that the beautiful creamy paper deserved to be written on with a real nib instead of being scratched with an ink pencil. Actually, he was not used to writing by hand. Apart from very short notes, it was usual to dictate everything into the speakwrite, which was, of course, impossible for his present purpose. He dipped the pen into the ink and then faltered for just a second. A tremor had gone through his bowels. To mark the paper was the decisive act. In small, clumsy letters, he wrote, April 4th, 1984. He sat back. A sense of complete helplessness had descended upon him. To begin with, he did not know with any certainty that this was 1984. It must be round about that date, since he was fairly sure that his age was 39... and he believed that he had been born in 1944 or 1945. but it was never possible nowadays to pin down any date within a year or two. For whom, it suddenly occurred to him to wonder, was he writing this diary? For the future, for the unborn. His mind hovered for a moment around the doubtful date on the page and then fetched up with a bump against the newspeak word doublethink. For the first time, the magnitude of what he had undertaken came home to him. How could you communicate with the future? It was of its nature impossible. Either the future would resemble the present, in which case it would not listen to him, or it would be different from it, and his predicament would be meaningless. For some time he sat gazing stupidly at the paper. The telescreen had changed over to strident military music, and it was curious that he seemed not merely to have lost the power of expressing himself, but even to have forgotten what it was that he had originally intended to say.
Again, that is a reading of George Orwell's 1984, read by Charles Morgan at our sister station KPFK in Los Angeles in 1975. I really enjoy listening to Charles Morgan read 1984. I'm an audiobook guy, and I like audiobooks, but narration is so important. It could be a great book, but if you don't have a good narrator, it just, I'm unable to get into it. And this is the very best reading of 1984 that I have heard. And it originally aired as a special, a lengthy special on KPFK back in 1975. Just shows the staying power of this book. 1984, published in 1949, and always makes its a comeback again and again and again because it holds certain eternal truths. And George Orwell was very keen on observing language and how language is used. And I think it's very important to think about how language is used today with such things as alternative facts. And alternative facts is an obvious one. I think anyone who heard it probably thought of George Orwell immediately. But there's a lot more going on beneath the surface than just what Kellyanne Conway said on a political talk show. This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I need just a moment to appeal to you for a financial contribution so that we can continue to do this type of work and have it air on this radio station. KPFA is in the final few days of its winter 2017 fund drive. At this moment, we are about $185,000 away from our overall goal. It's been a solid drive, actually, overall for the radio station. Of course, I'm mixing it up today because my ability to bring regular programming in the last few days and still reach our $3,000 goal has not been happening. So, and there is a responsibility for us, especially for people who do a radio program every day, to raise a certain amount of money, as there should be, in order, and for us to be able to do our part, carry our weight, here at the radio station. So, I'm still very happy to be able to bring, whenever I can, Charles Morgan reading 1984 by George Orwell. I'm also very happy to be able to offer you not just this radio reading of 1984, but almost all the greatness of Pacifica Radio over the last almost now 68 years. And it for a $200 pledge, our thank you gift to you this hour is the Pacifica Radio Archives 200 Voices. And it's 200 people that are featured and many speeches by these people, just not a speech per person, but a speech. And don't say, for example, Malcolm X. There are 11 speeches from Malcolm X in this collection. A number of speeches from Angela Davis. A whole lot of material of Alan Watts, who was a 20th century philosopher who was very influential in bringing world religion and philosophy to a Western audience, to an American audience, and perhaps even more specifically to a Bay Area audience, as he did it through a radio program here called Way Beyond the West between 1953 and 1973. You get the entire radio recording of 1984. You get Ralph Ellison's radio reading of his classic book, The Invisible Man, as well as Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. It's just incredible, everything that is on here. You get it for a pledge of $200. I'm not sure how long we're going to keep it at that $200 pledge rate, because it's been noticed by many, including some of you, that this is way undervalued. I mean, if you were to get everything that was in here individually, it would be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. You can get it. You might be able to make that by putting this on the black market, right? Now, I don't want to say that's going to work or endorse anything like that, of course, but I'm just saying this is pretty incredible, and it's yours for a pledge of $200. Comes on a USB drive that you plug into your computer, and then you can use the sound any way that you wish. So here's the phone number. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge also online at kpfa.org. In this collection, we have Allen Ginsberg, Alice Walker, Ray Bradbury, right? Fahrenheit, was it 451? If I got that one wrong, I probably did, but I'll have to relook. I think I did, you know, live radio sometimes. Dylan Thomas, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Lena Horne, Elsa Knight Thompson, a great radio broadcaster here at KPFA, Gore Vidal, and a number of speeches by Gore Vidal, which are always funny and witty and interesting and polemic. Gore Vidal, a number of speeches you get from him as well. 1-800-439-5732. That's the phone number. 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. We're now going to return to another excerpt of Charles Morgan reading George Orwell's 1984. Again, this originally aired on our sister station, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his breast in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. The hallway smelt of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, a colored poster, too large for indoor display, had been tacked to the wall. It depicted simply an enormous face more than a meter wide, the face of a man of about 45 with a heavy black mustache and ruggedly handsome features. Winston made for the stairs. It was no use trying the lift. Even at the best of times, it was seldom working, and at present, the electric current was cut off during daylight hours. It was part of the economy drive in preparation for Hate Week. The flat was 7 flights up, and Winston, who was 39 and had a varicose ulcer above his right ankle, went slowly, resting several times on the way. On each landing, opposite the lift shaft, the poster with the enormous face gazed from the wall. It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you about when you move. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption beneath it ran. And inside the flat, a fruity voice was reading out a list of figures which had something to do with the production of pig iron. The voice came from an oblong metal plaque like a dulled mirror which formed part of the surface of the right-hand wall. Winston turned a switch and the voice sank somewhat, though the words were still distinguishable. The instrument, the telescreen it was called, could be dimmed, but there was no way of shutting it off completely. He moved over to the window. The smallish, frail figure, the meagerness of his body merely emphasized by the blue overalls which were the uniform of the party. His hair was very fair, his face naturally sanguine, his skin roughened by coarse soap and blunt razor blades in the cold of the winter that had just ended. Outside, even through the shut window pane, the world looked cold. Down in the street, little eddies of wind were whirling dust and torn paper into spirals, and though the sun was shining and the sky a harsh blue, there seemed to be no color in anything. except the posters that were plastered everywhere. The black mustachioed face gazed down from every commanding corner. There was one on the house front immediately opposite. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption said, while the dark eyes looked deeply into Winston's own. Down at street level, another poster, torn at one corner, flapped fitfully in the wind, alternately covering and uncovering the single word "Ingsos." In the far distance, a helicopter skimmed down between the roofs, hovered for an instant like a blue bottle, and darted away again with a curving flight. It was the police patrol snooping into people's windows. And the patrols did not matter, however, only the thought police mattered. Behind Winston's back, the voice from the telescreen was still babbling away about pig iron and the overfulfillment of the 9th 3-year plan. The telescreen received and transmitted simultaneously. Any sound that Winston made above the level of a very low whisper would be picked up by it. Moreover, so long as he remained within the field of vision which the metal plaque commanded, he could be seen as well as heard. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment, how often or on what system the thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. It was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time. But at any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live, did live, from habit that became instinct, in the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every movement scrutinized.
Again, Charles Morgan reading 1984 by George Orwell in 1975 on our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Letters on Politics, and you're listening to KPFA, where we are in the final stretch of our winter 2017 fund drive. I do have a fundraising update for you. We have raised $1,000 towards that $3,000 goal, which we're trying to make today. Very important that we do. This has been one of our most popular thank you gifts, and I completely understand why. It has 1,350 hours of material featuring multiple speeches or events, like from Angela Davis and Bobby Seale, John Coltrane, Leonard Cohen, who's just passed away, Martin Luther King Jr., the full audiobook is really, and it was read on radio 1984, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Gore Vidal, Bob Dylan, Malcolm X, 11 speeches from Malcolm X on this, Paul Robeson, Rosa Parks, George Carlin, very important in our history. It was when our sister station WBAI in New York City in the 1970s aired one of his comedy routines full of expletives. Well, they got the government came down hard on them, and that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and that's why we can't say expletives today. I still don't believe we'd be able to say expletives on radio today, even without that case, but that was the case that ended up being the cornerstone in that whole issue. Again, you get this on a USB drive for a pledge of $200. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. I do want to thank Isaac and Bay Point. I grew up out there, a little bit farther past Bay Point, but not much farther. Small town called Oakley. But when I see Bay Point, I think of where I grew up. And also Barbara in Santa Cruz, listening to K248BR, I'm assuming. And Barbara, that was quite generous of you, and I'm very thankful to you for your generosity. 1-800-439-5732. That's the phone number. 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. Roger in San Francisco. Roger, thank you so much for your contribution today as well. Interestingly, you got an email this hour from one of our friendly listeners. Well, let me just say one of our friends. I won't say his name because, well, I don't know if he expected this to make it to the airwaves, so I will not say his name. But he just has some thoughts about fundraising. And I'll quote him here. I wonder if you guys are too nice about the pledge drives. you may be onto something. You know, maybe I have been too nice, and maybe we need to change that around. So, all right, people, hand it over. Give it up. No more playing around. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org. He has much more of an analysis of that. He says, in other words, make your listeners experience directly and painfully what it would be like if KPFA suddenly vanished from the airwaves. And make it clear that it won't come back until our targets are reached. Wow, we should hire this guy to run our fund drives, maybe. But it's true, if we are unable to reach our goals, we lose this. We lose this radio station. We lose the ability to keep many of the legacies of the people that we're talking about right now alive. And it's important we keep it going right now, because there's so many people out there that are seeking information and language and ideas to match the angst that they're feeling in this new political terrain. And that's what we could do together. You can give this as a gift to somebody, right? 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org. Anyways, let's get back to some more Charles Morgan reading George Orwell's 1984.
At each stage of his imprisonment, Winston had known or seemed to know whereabouts he was in the windowless building. Possibly there were slight differences in the air pressure. The cells where the guards had beaten him were below ground level. The room where he had been interrogated by O'Brien was high up near the roof. And this place was many meters underground, as deep down as it was possible to go. It was bigger than most of the cells he had been in, but he hardly noticed his surroundings. All he noticed was that there were two small tables straight in front of him, each covered with green baize. One was only a meter or two from him. The other was further away near the door. He was strapped upright in a chair so tightly that he could move nothing, not even his head. A sort of pad gripped his head from behind, forcing him to look straight in front of him. For a moment, he was alone, and then the door opened, and O'Brien came in. You asked me once what was in room 101. I told you that you knew the answer already. Everyone knows it. The thing that is in room 101 is the worst thing in the world. Shall I tell you why we have brought you here? To cure you. To make you sane. Will you understand, Winston, that no one whom we bring to this place ever leaves our hands uncured? We are not interested in those stupid crimes that you've committed. The party is not interested in the overt act. The thought is all we care about. We do not merely destroy our enemies, we change them. Do you understand what I mean by that? He was bending over Winston. His face looked enormous because of its nearness, and hideously ugly because it was seen from below. Moreover, it was filled with a sort of exaltation, a lunatic intensity. Again, Winston's heart shrank. If it had been possible, he would have cowered deeper into the bed. He felt certain that O'Brien was about to twist the dial out of sheer wantonness. At this moment, however, O'Brien turned away. He took a pace or two up and down, then he continued less vehemently. The first thing for you to understand is that in this place there are no martyrdoms. You've read of the religious persecutions of the past. In the Middle Ages, there was the Inquisition. It was a failure. It set out to eradicate heresy and ended by perpetuating it. For every heretic it burned at the stake, thousands of others rose up. Why was that? Because the Inquisition killed its enemies in the open and killed them while they were still unrepentant. In fact, It killed them because they were unrepentant. Men were dying because they would not abandon their true beliefs. Naturally, all the glory belonged to the victim, and all the shame to the inquisitor who burned them. Later, in the 20th century, there were the totalitarians, as they were called. There were the German Nazis and the Russian communists. The Russians persecuted heresy more cruelly than the Inquisition had done. They imagined that they had learned from the mistakes of the past. They knew at any rate that one must not make martyrs. Before they exposed their victims to public trial, they deliberately set themselves to destroy their dignity. They wore them down by torture and solitude until they were despicable, cringing wretches, confessing whatever was put into their mouths, covering themselves with abuse, accusing and sheltering behind one another, whimpering for mercy. And yet, after only a few years, the same thing had happened over again. The dead men had become martyrs, and their degradation was forgotten. Once again, why was it? In the first place, because the confessions that they had made were obviously extorted and untrue. We do not make mistakes of that kind. All the confessions that are uttered here are true. We make them true. And above all, we do not allow the dead to rise up against us. You must stop imagining that posterity will vindicate you, Winston. Posterity will never hear of you. You will be lifted clean out from the stream of history. We shall turn you into gas and pour you into the stratosphere. Nothing will remain of you, not a name in a register, not a memory in a living brain. You will be annihilated in the past as well as in the future. You will never have existed.
My goodness. Charles Morgan's reading 1984 by George Orwell. My friends, a fundraising update. So far this hour, we've raised about $1,600. We're just over halfway towards our $3,000 goal. And I'm a little bit worried here that if I am unable to raise that amount of money this hour, they very well may put me in room 101. And we all know that's very terrible. Though for some of you, sure wouldn't mind that at all if that happened, but I don't want that to happen. Again, for a pledge of $200, this entire, sort of the greatness of Pacifica Radio over the 68 years of its existence, 1,350 hours of material, the premium stuff that has happened over the years at this radio station and also our sister radio stations is yours on a USB drive for $200. The number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. We are down to our final 5 minutes. We can make it, but I'm going to need people that are able to make that donation today to do so. You can still make a donation of $25 or $50 or even $1,000. It's everyone doing their part that makes this happen. We do want you to feel good about the donation that you make to this radio station because that is our relationship and that is what is the foundation of public broadcasting. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. I do want to thank Alexandra in San Francisco. Thank you so much. We've had another donor all the way in Annapolis. I imagine listening to kpfa.org. We're also equally appreciative of that contribution. It's just amazing everything that is on this jump drive. Again, George Orwell's 1984, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Fyodor Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. Shenley and Martinez. I love Martinez. You know, an aunt who lived in Martinez who I used to go visit and stay with her when I was a kid. We watch Creature Features. People remember Creature Features? I'd go with it. She was a horror movie fan. And as a kid, I was too, until I realized the horror was in reality. But 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online, kpfa.org. Tani in Santa Rosa. Tani, thank you for your generosity. And Deborah in Paradise. Where actually, I have another aunt. look, people, I'm a Bay Area kid. Anyways, Deborah in Paradise, thank you so much. And Anya in Cupertino. Anya, I'm greatly appreciative of your support today as well. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. I remember I got to, in a very small way, participate in the reading of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. It's when I was a congressional correspondent, and I lived in Washington, D.C., and I was asked by the Pacifica Radio Archives to go and record Helen Thomas. You'll remember Helen Thomas, the great longtime White House correspondent, one who got just, you know, under every president's skin and just went after every one of them. Well, she read an excerpt of War and Peace, and then I got to interview her a little bit about that afterwards. I remember I was very happy because I got to play on Democracy Now!, so that was really exciting early on in my career, a moment that I will never forget. But you get such great luminaries like that reading really important pieces of fiction, because, of course, fiction sometimes tells deeper truths, and I would argue that is very true for George Orwell's 1984. So the number again is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. A new fundraising update here. It looks like we're at about $2,000. We need to get to $3,000, but that could be five people pledging right now at the $200 rate and getting this entire 1,350 hours of material from the greatest, you know, the Black Panthers. So many events and speeches from the Black Panthers, and you get it in their own voice, right? Yeah, I mean, you get it straight from the source. You're not just reading it, but you're also experiencing it. You're making history real. Fidel Castro, Russell Means, Molly Ivins is a part of this. Neil deGrasse Tyson and a whole collection of stuff with Michio Kaku. So you're going to get your science in here as well. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. Look, my friends, we are 80% of the way through this fund drive. We're almost done. We're 70% of the way towards the overall goal. So every hour is going to have to really count. If I cannot make that goal this hour, I'm sure they're sending me to room 101. But 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. Look, you can still help us get to that goal. You look, $1,000 pledge and we make the goal. $500 pledge, you get us halfway there, right? 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. Still get your call in the next couple of minutes. It will help us try to get where we need to be and count for us. So here's the number one last time, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org.
FM, 97.5 FM, K248BR in Santa Cruz, all the time at kpfa.org. Time for Project Censored.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will be back next month. Today we'll be listening to audio excerpts from a vital new documentary, The Coming War on China, by veteran journalist John Pilger. Please stay with us.
That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for a mighty dollar bill.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will be back next month, and next week we'll have a great show for you. We've got a conversation with Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot. Later in the month on the Project Censored Show, Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Bayham will be on with Project Censored interns, so keep tuning in Fridays at 1 o'clock. You know what today is. It's the next to the last day of the KPFA Fund Drive, and we have another stellar program for you today. And because this is a brand new documentary of great import, global significance, we're going to be sharing with you again today the one and only John Pilger's The Coming War on China. So today we're going to be playing excerpts from The Coming War on China. We also interviewed John Pilger last week, so we may be hearing some more clips from that conversation. And this film, The Coming War on China, it looks at life in China today, as well as the history of U.S. military activity throughout the Pacific. And Pilger makes the case that the U.S. has now surrounded China with military installations, as if preparing for a future conflict, including Obama's Asian pivot. We spoke of that. John Pilger, just to give a proper introduction, was born in Australia, began a career there, although he's now spent most of his adult life in Britain. He did work at the Daily Mirror newspaper for 23 years. Then for another 23 years, he wrote a column for the New Statesman magazine. But John Pilger is best known for his documentary films. He's made more than 50. What an incredible career John Pilger has had, and it's an honor at Project Censored to share his work with you. Certainly, he's done work on the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, the Indonesian occupation of East Timor, Australia's treatment of its Aboriginal populations, the continuing oppression of Palestine, and the many U.S. interventions in Latin America. And one of our favorite films of John Pilger is The War You Don't See, on war propaganda that became the film you didn't see when it was actually censored for some time in the United States, and that's another issue that we wrote about in Project Censored, in our Censored 2014 book. At any rate, The Coming War on China, Pilger's latest film, was released late last year. It's a wide-ranging documentary that looks at the history of U.S. military activities in the Pacific, also U.S. attitudes toward Asia, Pacific peoples, and current conditions inside China. So you can get this film for a $100 pledge to KPFA Free Speech Radio by calling 800-439-5732. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. $100 gets you this great brand-new DVD. You'd be the first one on the block to have it, The Coming War on China. For $120, we've got Censored 2017, our 40th anniversary edition, ever timely, with the top underreported stories and media analysis of the year. You can get both for $200, but more importantly, we're coming up on the goal here at Free Speech Radio, and we need you to call in. And I love when you call in during this hour, because I come down here from the North Bay, and it's great to see the phones light up and see people calling in and appreciating the work that Peter Phillips and I and our crew do at Project Censored Show, with the great help of people behind the scenes like Anthony Fest, our producer, and Erica Bridgman, our engineer. So 800-439-5732, those are the numbers to call. Please get them going, and you can also pledge online at kpfa.org. So let's get on to the program. Let's hear an audio excerpt from the opening minutes of The Coming War on China.
I pity a country that would come up against us. The synergy with air, land, and sea forces, and our ability to control the battle space and seize the high ground is devastating. All countries respect the power of the United States, and they respect how dominant we are in this region. And we get better and better and better.
Tonight at 10, a rare glimpse of China's ambitious expansion in one of the world's most contested regions. We report from the South China Sea, where the Chinese are warning off anyone who comes too close to their building program.
We continue our look this morning at what China does not want you to see. The United States says the superpower is reclaiming land in the South China Sea.
The fact that we're dealing with a situation right now where we, the U.S., has to be much more aggressive in dealing with the Chinese government.
CNN has learned that the U.S. Navy is about to send a destroyer there. Let's go to our CNN chief.
CNN got exclusive access to classified U.S. surveillance flights over the islands.
The threat of China is becoming big news. The media is beating the drums of war as the world is being primed to regard China as a new enemy.
China's alarming creation of entirely new territory in the South China Sea is one part of a broader military push that some fear is to challenge U.S. dominance in the region.
China is building airstrips in the South China Sea on disputed islands condemned by an international tribunal. This is now a flashpoint for war between China and America. What is not news is that China itself is under threat. These American bases form a giant noose encircling China with missiles, bombers, warships, all the way from Australia through the Pacific to Asia and beyond.
I mean, if you were in Beijing looking out, you stood on the tallest building in Beijing and looked out at the Pacific Ocean, you'd see American warships. You'd see Guam is about to sink because there's so many missiles pointed at China. You'd look up at Korea and see American armaments pointing at China. You'd see Japan, which is basically Japan's a glove over the American fist. I think if I was Chinese, I'd have a little to worry about American aggressiveness.
And we have China surrounded, and we're doing more all the time to try and keep it surrounded and deepen that containment of China. But China presents a fascinating case of a country that is independent, doesn't have foreign bases on its territory, growing very rapidly, not as rapidly now as it did for 30 years, but still the second-ranking economy in the world.
We have an adversary. And that adversary is China. And that adversary, unless there is dramatic reform inside China, will be our enemy someday.
One myth I think really that needs to be dispelled is that somehow China's aiming to replace America and going to run the world. Yes. It's not, well, first of all, the Chinese are not that stupid. The West, with its Christian roots, are about converting other people into their beliefs. The Chinese are not about that. It's just the I'm not degrading the Western culture. I'm just pointing out the inherent nature, the DNA of two different cultures. The Chinese 2,000 years ago built the Great Wall to keep the barbarians out, not to invade them.
As the world's economic power moves rapidly to Asia, the response of the United States is to deploy the majority of its naval forces to Asia and the Pacific. This massive military buildup is known in Washington as the pivot to Asia. The target is China. The great power game in the 21st century is called perpetual war. America's unchallenged arms industry, the annual prize is huge profits from almost $600 billion of military spending.
You heard that right. $600 billion in military spending. That was journalist and filmmaker John Pilger from his latest film, The Coming War on China. And for a sense of perspective on that figure, and by the way, electored President Donald Trump recently asked for an additional $54 billion for military spending. This figure, over $600 billion, is bigger than the entire economies of many nations. It's bigger than the economy of Iraq, Vietnam, Sweden. It's twice the size of the Portuguese economy or the Greek economy.
So the United States is outspending much of the world on, quote, defense, as they say in Orwellian doublespeak. You know, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and we're listening to audio excerpts from a new documentary, The Coming War on China, by veteran journalist John Pilger. And we have these great premiums for you to thank you for supporting Free Speech Radio. For $100, you can get this film. It's a fantastic film, The Coming War on China. Very important film. A lot of material that you do not hear about or see in the U.S. press. $100 pledge gets you that DVD. For $120, you get a whole book of things that aren't in the U.S. press. It's Project Censored's 2017 40th anniversary book. For $200, you get the film. You get the book. But you also get the sense of community and supporting this free speech radio station. We have another day left in the fund drive. It will be fantastic to really come so close to meeting our goal. We're very close to meeting the goal right now. And, of course, tomorrow, Saturday, you're going to hear from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. That's correct. You're going to hear a Grateful Dead marathon if you last that long. You can pledge all day tomorrow as well. And I know that's a popular program, and certainly you can call in tomorrow and support KPFA. But I'd like if you could call in now. 800-439-5732. That's the number. 800-439-5732. 800-HEY-KPFA. You can pledge online at kpfa.org. 800-439-5732. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. And we're on about 40 stations around the U.S. now, but home base is right here in Berkeley, California. So we'd love it if you could call in and show your support for this kind of programming. And again, we have great premiums for you. So call in, 800-439-5732. I would like to continue sharing with you information from this fantastic film by John Pilger. And we're listening to sound clips from Pilger's new documentary, The Coming War on China. And in the movie, Pilger speaks with Pacific Island residents and their representatives, U.S. diplomatic and military officials, Chinese scholars and activists, and many others. In looking at the history of U.S. relations with China and the attitudes toward Chinese people, here's part of a conversation John Pilger had with James Bradley, author of the new book, The China Mirage.
This is Shanghai, the historic port on the Yangtze River, China's greatest city. I had arranged to meet the American author James Bradley, whose latest best-selling book, The China Mirage, reveals an extraordinary hidden history of American power and modern China.
It was almost illegal for someone like me to know a Chinese for almost all of American history. The Chinese came to America to mine gold and build the railroads, and Americans decided we didn't like the competition. So in 1882, we had the Chinese Exclusion Acts, which kept the Chinese out of the United States for about 100 years. So you have the largest population in the world that can't come to the United States. So at just the point we're putting up the Statue of Liberty saying, we welcome everybody. We were erecting a wall saying, we welcome everybody except those Chinese.
Fear of a rising China today is the latest chapter in a history of propaganda that presented the Chinese as uncouth and infantile. To Western popular and political culture, the Chinese became the yellow peril, and racial stereotypes bore the constant theme of fear and threat.
Boris Karloff as the evil Fu Manchu, his passion for power twisting his brilliant mind as he revels in the horrors of human sacrifice and torture. Behind the mask of Fu Manchu.
This caricature of an entire people concealed another agenda, opium.
For the American elite in the 19th century, China was a goldmine of drugs.
Warren Delano, the grandfather of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was the American opium king of China. He was the biggest American opium dealer, second to the British. He welcomed the first American ship into China to help out with the opium wars. Much of the East Coast of America, Columbia, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, were born from opium money. The American Industrial Revolution was funded by huge pools of money. Where did this come from? It came from illegal drugs in the biggest market in the world, China.
Let me get this right. The grandfather of arguably the most liberal president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was a drug runner.
Yes, sir. Franklin Delano Roosevelt never made much money in his life. He had public service jobs that were very lowly paid, but he had yachts, he had summer homes, he had mansions in New York City. The kids went to private schools. He inherited a fortune from Warren Delano, his father, who was the American opium king of China. If you scratch anyone with the name Forbes in their name, John Forbes Kerry, Secretary of State John Forbes Kerry, you'll find opium money. His great-grandfather was an opium dealer. How big was opium money? Opium money built the first industrial city in the United States, Lowell, Massachusetts. It built the first five railroads in the United States. Opium money all over the East Coast, but it wasn't talked about. It was called the China trade. And if you go to various museums, you can see teas and silks exhibited, and they keep quiet about all that big opium money.
In the scramble to get opium money, China was invaded and colonized by Britain and the other imperial powers. Foreign armies grabbed whole swathes of China. This is the American army in Tiananmen Square, Peking, in 1900. Great cities like Shanghai were taken over and declared concessions. And foreigners lived a life of privilege and luxury amidst terrible poverty imposed on the Chinese. A resistance known as the Boxer Rebellion was put down with a savagery. This rape of China set the tone for how China was perceived in the West well into the 20th century.
This is the Project Censored Show on KPFA. I'm Icky Huff, and we're listening to excerpts from The Coming War on China. It's a new documentary from veteran journalist John Pilger. Pilger joined us live on the Project Censored Show last week, and among the questions we asked him was what kind of reception the film has had. He replied that it's been well received in many parts of the world, but hardly broadcast at all here in the U.S. And that has been typical for his work. Here's John Pilger talking about this issue.
When you produce a film like this that really questions U.S. power, questions the origins and nature and shape of U.S. power, it's not shown in the United States. Probably those clips that you ran there is one of the very few times I would have thought that Americans have actually heard the film, certainly, or heard about it. Whereas the film was made initially for where I make most of my films, in Britain, and was shown on network television last December in Britain and in cinemas, and had a four-star reception and reviews and so on. It's currently being shown where I am in Australia, where it'll be shown on network television and in cinemas, and it'll be shown in other countries. It's actually been shown in China within a day or so of it coming out in the UK. The film was subtitled in Chinese and put up on YouTube all over China. My point is that it's being shown all over the world, but the U.S., which has constitutionally probably the freest press and media in the world, doesn't show this kind of film. You will see it in an independent cinema here and there, perhaps on independent cable television, and you will hear about it on KPFA. But you won't otherwise know about it because there is no free mainstream media in the United States. In all the documentary films I've made, many of them with the U.S. and U.S. power as a subject, they simply have either not been shown in the U.S. or have struggled to be shown. So it's very important that your listeners understand that, and that this is an opportunity to see a film that looks at the United States from outside, not just from outside, it looks at it from the point of view of millions of its own citizens who are not allowed to have a free media. And I don't say that as some kind of rhetorical judgment, it's just a fact.
Some kind of rhetorical judgment. No, right? It's really just a fact that in the United States, these are films we don't see. These are stories we don't hear. They are not part of the agenda of the six corporations that control 90% of the media. And that's why we're here at KPFA, at Pacifica, at Free Speech Radio. And that's also why we're asking you to show your support for this kind of programming that you don't hear anywhere else. Corporate media apparently think this documentary isn't worth your time, but we say it is. No government censor tells them not to show a film. People censor it themselves instead. These institutions will not show it to you, right? We're talking about different kinds of censorship here, not the government censorship that we know happens, because we know Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden and the NSA files, and we know Chelsea Manning and collateral murder videos. We know the government keeps secrets. But more insidiously, corporate media censor every day by degree. And at KPFA, we deconstruct that architecture of the supposed free press. And at Project Censored, we do that with a book every year, with a radio show every week. And it's because of KPFA that we're able to come to you on the people's airwaves every week. And now we're on 40 stations around the U.S. And you calling in helps keep places like KPFA alive, this historic institution. Won't you call and support now during the Project Censored show? Calling 800-439-5732. That gets you The Coming War on China, the great DVD by John Pilger. It's only $100. The Censored 2017 40th Anniversary Edition book is $120. You can get both for $200 and get us $200 closer to our goal. And the fund drive is almost over, folks. But we really need you to call in. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. KPFA.org. That is a place you can go online and pledge there and ask for John Pilger's film, The Coming War on China, $100. Censored 2017, $120. Book and DVD, $200. 800-439-5732. That is the number to call. We're looking today in more detail at U.S.-Chinese relations and history, and you heard some startling things, I'm imagining, about 10 minutes ago when you heard about the Roosevelt family and the Forbes family, and you heard about drug running, the opium trade, accompanied by the demonization of Chinese immigrants and the so-called racist yellow peril. You're not making this stuff up, folks. This is real untold history, and we're telling it right now on the air at KPFA. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, and we're listening to John Pilger's new documentary, Excerpts from the Coming War on China. And again, we'd like to share more of this with you, because you're not going to get this in one place. This is 2 hours of history running up to the present about U.S.-Chinese relations. And in our next excerpt, we're going to hear selections from John Pilger's interviews with several commentators inside of China. But please keep the calls coming while we share this with you. 800-439-5732. 800-439-5732. 239-5732. Keep the calls coming because I really want to share more of this information with you. Here's a selection from Pilger and interviews with several commentators inside China.
I'd arranged to see Professor Zhang Weiwei, a close aide to the late Deng Xiaoping, the man who changed China.
Deng is really extremely long-term visionary, a leader with exceedingly long-term strategic vision for his country, for his people. And China is still following that path. Yeah. Actually, this is really a tradition from China's long history. Mm-hmm. You look at even like Mao, you know, he said, we should, you know, surpass UK by which year. We should surpass United States by which year. So this tradition continues to this day. Even Xi Jinping today is also doing the same. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Actually, what many Chinese have problem with Western media is these stereotypes about China. If you are, you are content with stereotypes, you miss so many things. You know, if BBC broadcast something, they are happy to always mention this communist dictatorship, this autocracy. No, actually, with this kind of label, you know, you cannot understand this China as it is. But if you watch BBC or CNN or read Economist and try to understand China, it will be a failure. It's impossible.
Multiple parties fight for political power and everyone voting on them as the only path to salvation for the long-suffering developing
world. This is Eric Lee, a Shanghai entrepreneur, educated in America, and typical of a new, confident, outspoken political class.
Now, in China, there are a lot of problems. But at the moment, the Chinese, the party state, has proven an extraordinary ability to change. I mean, I make the joke, in America, you can change political parties, but you can't change the policies. In China, you cannot change the party, but you can change policies. So in the 65 or 66 years, China's been run by one single party, yet the political changes have taken place in China in this past 66 years have been wider and broader and greater than probably any other major country in modern memory.
So in that time, China ceased to be communist. Is that what you're saying?
Well, China is a market economy, and it's a vibrant market economy, but it is not a capitalist country. Here's why. There's no way a group of billionaires could control the Politburo, as billionaires control American policymaking. So in China, you have a vibrant market economy, but capital does not rise above political authority. Capital is not, does not have enshrined rights. In America, capital, the interest of capital and capital itself has risen above the American nation. The political authority cannot check the power of capital. And that's why America is a capitalist country, but China is not.
Zhang Lijia, a journalist and critic who lives in Beijing.
Many Americans imagine that the Chinese people live a miserable, repressed life with no freedom whatsoever. That's not quite true. If you speak to many ordinary Chinese people, they will tell you they feel their life are quite free. Some 500 million people have been lifted out of poverty, and some would say probably 600 million people. That's a great achievement. For many Americans, the yellow peril has never left them. Mm. I think there's the fear about China. Of course, there's the fear of China's rapid rise, but it also has a lot to do with China's the label as a communist and state.
China's objectives are modest compared with their weight. They're not trying to run the world. They're not even trying to run Asia Pacific. I think they want to keep America from dominating the Asia Pacific. So they have what they believe is their rightful place in Asia Pacific because of the long civilization, long history, and their size. So their objectives are really modest compared with their capacity.
The wealth, the new wealth in China, mm-hmm. they often say this is the product of mm-hmm. self-made entrepreneurial mm-hmm. skill.
Yeah.
But is it not also the product of the exploitation of people at the bottom, what are known in China as migrants, but they're not really migrants, they're Chinese.
If you really, you know, go to talk to these migrant workers, you will find, quite surprisingly, over the past 5 to 7 years, they have experienced a greater income increase than any other social groups. China is not a class society.
But China is a class society.
We're listening to clips from John Pilger's new documentary, The Coming War on China. And in this film, Pilger speaks with many people in the U.S. and in China and around the region about these issues, the U.S.-Chinese relations. And we have this film available. We have it available for you today by calling and supporting KPFA Free Speech Radio. And I am now joined in studio by our producer, Anthony Fest, who's come out from behind the curtain to get behind the microphone. Anthony.
Yeah, thank you, Mickey. And again, I want to urge everyone to please call that number now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Two people have called thus far, Michael in Oakland, and what is that name? A caller.
A seat
in San Rafael. Thank you both for your calls. We need many more, though, at 1-800-439-5732 or pledge online at www.kpfa.org. This is a remarkable documentary that John Pilger has made, the latest in many, many dozens of documentaries that John Pilger has made. And what a sweep it covers from the history going back to the 19th century to the incredible racist stereotypes of Chinese people that were foisted in this country on up to the present day, and the apparent intent of the U.S. to build not a wall, but a ring of military bases all around China. Please pick up a copy of this documentary for yourself or for your school. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. That's available with a $100 pledge. Or with the $120 pledge, Censored 2017, Project Censored's annual book of underreported or unreported stories and media analysis. That's over 400 pages, and yet it's in little small chapters. You can read it a chapter at a time, and it'll be very worthwhile. And a little bonus you'd find with this book is the amazing cartoons of Khalil Bendib, the political cartoonist par excellence, and who also happens to be a programmer here at KPFA. He's one of the producers of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. So 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732 makes it all happen. $100 pledge for The Coming War on China by John Pilger, $120 for Censored 2017. And we should also give our thanks to Peter and Mickey for hosting this program for these 6 years now. And they're an example of a class of people that I want to thank, and those are academics who don't merely stay within the classroom and the faculty lounge, but they take their expertise and their learning and their scholarly cred out into the community. Peter teaches at Sonoma State. You, Mickey, teach at Diablo Valley College. We've got a couple new hosts at Project Censored on board now, Nick Bayham, who teaches at Cal State East Bay, and Nolan Higdon, who divides his time among several Bay Area institutions. These academics are lending, as I say, their expertise to our work here at KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. The most important thing is to support this program and this radio station. 1-800-439-5732. Hopefully you can afford the coming war on China. It's a remarkable educational film, or the Project Censor 2017, Project Censored's annual book for a $120 pledge. Mickey?
Indeed. Thank you, Anthony. You know, John Pilger's documentary, The Coming War on China, he's elicited adroit observations from his interview guests. Pilger is not attempting to be an apologist for the Chinese government, however, or the effects its policies have had on the Chinese people. And we, too, take a people's perspective. And, of course, here at KPFA, we want to share all of this kind of information. And you heard Anthony talking about the role of the public intellectual, right, in a place like the United States.
Absolutely.
In a place like the United States that has some kind of real vibes of anti-intellectualism over the decades. It can be rough out there. And Peter Phillips and I know Nolan and Nick and others and other academics we work with, we like to get out and about. Just this week, I was at College of Marin giving a talk, San Francisco State University giving another talk. Next week in Petaluma, I'll be at Aquas Cafe with Linda Sartor talking about her work at the Project Censored Lecture Series, 6:30 Tuesday night. And later in the month, I'm giving a talk at the American Association of University Professors at Cal State Maritime, the Junior College, the Journalism Association of Community Colleges in Sacramento, April 1, plus the weekly radio show, plus all the teaching that we do. I mean, this is the point, is that we feel like that we have to share that information with folks. And KPFA is such an important platform and a megaphone to share that. And it's an honor to be here with Anthony and Erica Bridgman and all these great programmers and the wonderful volunteers and the people that work in the phone room. And by the way, the phone room is back open for business tomorrow. So announcement to everybody that wants to come and support the Grateful Dead all day long programming with David Gans. The phone room is open, and you can come on down from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. I'm not going to speculate about what might be going on for that long during the Grateful Dead shows, but you can come in and support KPFA. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. 800-439-5732.
And we want to say thank you to an anonymous donor on the peninsula who just provided a very generous gift. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. www.kpfa.org. Last week we had several, what I can guess we'll call them, financial angels who blessed us with their generosity. We could use a few more like that now. 1-800-439-5732. But of course, what we really need is for many of you to step up and make the small contribution that you can afford. But those many small contributions to add up to come to the budget that it takes to run KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. Whether or not you can afford these premiums, the important thing is to be a part of KPFA and make a pledge at 1-800-439-5732. Of course, one thing to remember is if $120 sounds a little steep, you can spread it over a year. It can come down
or
to
6 months.
$10 a month. That's
$20
much more manageable.
Yeah. $20 a month for half a year.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's $5 a week.
Yeah. So just make that happen, please, at 1-800-439-5732. And soon we'll be hearing more of this amazing documentary, The Coming War on China, and our interview with John Pilger, who joined us live on the air last week to tell us about the making of this documentary and the observations that didn't make it into some of the audio clips that we've been playing this afternoon. Do we have another caller? Yes, we do. Pat from Sonoma. Thank you, Pat.
North Bay represent.
1-800-439-5732. Still don't see anybody from San Francisco where I live, so anyone out there from the West Bay, please make that call now. 1-800-439-5732.
You know, as we mentioned earlier in the program, John Pilger joined us by phone on last week's Project Censored show, and one point he made in our conversation was that beginning with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Mao Zedong had sent communications to each U.S. president seeking to improve U.S.-Chinese relations, but that these messages they've been ignored. So let's listen to another cut from John Pilger's Coming War on China.
I tell the story, and it's a story that has been on the historical record for some time, of Mao's overtures. Mao Zedong made a number of overtures to presidents beginning with Franklin Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and I read from some of Mao's secret dispatches, which were sent to Washington, and which he says that, and I paraphrase him, that China wants to do a deal with the United States. China wants a close relationship with the United States. He was saying, in effect, look, we've got the people, you've got the expertise, let's come together and we can produce this extraordinary dynamo of a relationship. Now, this was coming from the communist leader of the world's biggest communist nation at the time. But communism has always been painted in such one-dimensional colors as a single monolith and always as a threat, that Mao's messages were not only ignored, but those who carried them, conscientious State Department people who went to China, met Mao, met his people, carried back these messages to Washington, they themselves were vilified, and several of them were drummed out of the State Department and almost prosecuted during the McCarthyite hysteria. And at one point in the 1950s, there wasn't a single Chinese-speaking official in the State Department. So the witch hunt had succeeded. And there is that sense of witch hunt is a constant theme throughout American politics. We see it at the moment going on and on. Now it's to do with Russia, which is a complete fabrication. Russia brought Trump to power or some nonsense. If anyone believes that, they will believe fairy tales forever. It's that witch hunting that has denied the American people the kind of information to which they have a right. The point about Mao's overtures was that they were lost opportunities, that way back during the Second World War, post-Second World War in the 1950s, China and the United States could have formed an entirely mutually respecting and beneficial relationship. It could have stop wars, save millions of lives of those who died in wars. It's a lesson in how societies, powerful societies, with their own interests, can understand each other and can work out some kind of relationship with each other that allows the rest of us to have the security of stability in the world.
John Pilger, thank you so much for joining us on the Project
Censorship.
You're
very welcome. Always good to be on KPFA. Thank you.
And that's John Pilger speaking to the Project Censored Show just a week ago. I'm Anthony Fest, producer of the program, and with me is host Mickey Huff. And let's go back to these things that John Pilger just told us in that audio clip. That information about Mao's unsuccessful attempts to build U.S.-China diplomatic and economic relationships, it was already known by scholars, but not so much by the general population. That's why we need journalists like John Pilger and media institutions like Project Censored and KPFA. Now, as it happens, last month marked the 45th anniversary of President Nixon's visit to China. But what if China had always been ready for better relations, but the door was kept closed by the U.S.? And in the present day, what can we conclude about U.S. intentions toward China? This is the kind of information we want to put out there. And you can obtain this documentary by John Pilger with a pledge now to 1-800-439-5732. We want to say thank you to Sarah in Oakland. She just pledged at 1-800-439-5732. Won't you do the same? I cannot overemphasize the implications of this, that this information that John Pilger was providing us in that last audio clip, an interview a week ago on KPFA. He wasn't the one who discovered this. He's just elaborating on what other people have known, and you may have known, Mickey, being a historian, that Mao had, even before the Chinese Revolution, was seeking out better relations with the U.S.
Was Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam.
Instead, he was walled off, and the American people were told, it's the yellow peril, it's communism, it's this, it's that. We cannot even communicate. We can't trade or communicate or have diplomatic relations with the largest country in the world by population, even to the extent that they purged the apparently China, somewhat China-friendly staff out of the State Department. And as John Pilger told us, wound up with our foreign ministry, this U.S. State Department, without any Chinese speakers. Is this cutting off your nose despite your face? It's astonishing, and yet that's the way it happened. And again, the implications, could the Korean War have been avoided? Could Vietnam
well, not certainly,
have happened?
Certainly the Vietnam War. Ho Chi mm-hmm. Minh was making overtures after World War II, and the U.S. helped turn things back over to French colonialists, only to fight 9 more years and lose at Dien Bien Phu when the Vietnamese fought for their independence, and then, of course, the fight thereafter, after Geneva Conventions, cutting the country in half. And, of course, the South Vietnam was not a real democracy, and it eventually had coups and assassinations and run by military dictators and so forth. You know, over 3 million Vietnamese people, over 3 million, right? And, of course, we look in the United States at the 58,175 deaths and the hundreds of thousands of Americans that were wounded and damaged and families torn asunder and the great divisiveness of the 1960s and the anti-war movement that helped put an end to the war in Vietnam. But that number, 3 million plus, right? That's what John Pilger is telling us here in this film, is that if we had more information and knowledge about the happenings and goings on, right, behind the scenes here, you know, perhaps the American public would rise up to the occasion.
And, you know, on the matter of Vietnam, you've read this, no doubt. Someone went and calculated that if all the names of all the Vietnamese dead had been added to the war memorial on the U.S. Mall, that memorial would extend east for I don't know how many miles. It's astounding. 3 million lost in one war, which was never even explained to the American people.
Indeed. Well, you can understand the coming war on China and what we could possibly do to prevent such things if you watch John Pilger's latest film, The Coming War on China. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. 800-439-5732. KPFA.org, $100 pledge, gets you John Pilger's latest DVD, The Coming War on China. You can also get the Censored 2017 40th Anniversary book for $120 pledge, both for $200, and that's $33 a month for 6 months. And if you break that down, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of, less than $10 a week. For $200 in 6 months, get you these great premiums, and it gets you to be a member of KPFA, so you can participate in KPFA activities here. We'd like to thank Gail in San Francisco. There we have a representative from San Francisco calling in. Thank you for supporting KPFA. Thank you for supporting the Project Censored show. And, you know, look, we've been covering these issues for a long time at Project Censored. We've covered the Asia Pivot. We covered issues with China. We've covered the conflicts, the colonial conflicts going on in Africa as a result of some of these policies. And, you know, we're coming up right now here on the 6th anniversary of Fukushima, which is right in the neighborhood in the Pacific over there by China in Japan. And that is spewing radioactive waste into the Pacific Ocean. You know, the New York Times was just musing and warning today that, Fukushima, residents are afraid to move back because of the radioactive bores, right? So apparently they're not worried about the radiation. They're just worried about the bores. This is the kind of information you get from the New York Times. If you want to find out what's really going on in Japan and Fukushima, you know, check out the Project Censored book. Story number 7 in our top 25 this year is No End in Sight for the Fukushima Disaster. And we go on and on about the things that are going on here in Fukushima, in Japan, and also around the region. And you can see more about that story in the Censored 2017 book. So that's why we are encouraging you to call. These are very timely affairs that are going on right now. Right. And not a lot of people are writing about this. You know, Dar Jamal and Truth Out. Linda Gunter wrote about it in The Ecologist. There's an article in Current Sociology. But by and large, you don't hear much about what's going on in Fukushima. And, you know, this is an opportunity for me to do something else that we do at KPFA. That's, you know, community calendar. There is a very important event going on tomorrow. FukushimaResponse.org. The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster 6 years later. This is Saturday, March 11, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Putnam Plaza in Petaluma, California. I know John Bertucci and a lot of the other friends here at Project Censored Show are going to be there, and that's a place where you can go and be part of solidarity with folks trying to educate us about nuclear power, the dangers of nuclear power, and what's going on 6 years later in Fukushima. Project Censored's been covering that story from the beginning. And we continue to cover that story, and unfortunately we have to continue covering it because it's still going on.
And let's remember, we've had as guests on this program more than once, Arnie and Maggie Gunderson, of those remarkable nuclear industry critics. They'll tell you about what's going on in Japan, about the problems with the destroyed reactor, and they'll also tell you about problems here in the U.S. and why nuclear power is no longer even economically viable here or anywhere. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Support this program. 1-800-439-5732. Support this station.
Special thanks to Sean and also Nestor, another call-in from San Francisco. Thank you for calling and supporting the Project Censored Show today. And we have another brief clip we want to share with you. And one of the recurring subjects of the coming war on China is the network of military bases the U.S. maintains throughout the Western Pacific, from Australia in the south to the Philippines, South Korea, Japan. And Japan's southern island province, Okinawa, it's only 350 miles from the Chinese mainland, and it's the site of a major U.S. military base. Many Okinawa residents want the U.S. forces gone, putting those Okinawans at odds with their national government in Tokyo. And in the coming war on China, we hear and see protests against the U.S. bases on Okinawa and South Korea's Jeju Island, among others. And here are comments from a ring of bases from two of the guests interviewed for the coming war on China. The first guest is from the University of Chicago, historian Bruce Cummings, followed by David Vine, author of the book Base Nation.
This is the center of an empire that never speaks its name, whose power is represented in this extraordinary world map of American military bases. Thousand bases in the United States, almost 1,000 bases spread across every continent.
The archipelago of empire, the bases that we have around the world, hidden in plain sight, are the real territory of our empire. But at the same time, we maintain independent governments in Japan or South Korea or Germany. They don't have autonomy when it comes to foreign policy. So it's a very sophisticated and effective system whereby we pat ourselves on the back for helping to midwife democracy in Japan and Germany and South Korea and various other places, while keeping the lid on, in that we don't know what these countries would do if they were fully independent. And the beauty of this system is that most people pay no attention to it at all. They think it's just a natural occurrence to have 50,000 American troops in Japan. No ocean has ever been dominated the way the U.S. dominates the Pacific. Navy and Air Force, they claim in the Pearl Harbor headquarters of the Pacific Command, they claim to be responsible for 52% of the Earth's surface. And when you look at their logo, it shows an eagle over the Aleutian Islands with one tail on coming down somewhere near Seattle and the other coming down right over Beijing. So Beijing looks at a network of bases, a real archipelago of empire that's been built up since the Korean War.
There's a growing collection of what are referred to as lily pad bases. These are bases that have typically 200-300 troops, no family members, very few amenities, and are often quite secretive. They're bases that are frequently constructed within a foreign country's base to disguise it, and generally are not referred to as bases.
Many of these bases have been set up to combat China's worldwide economic influence. From these bases, the United States operates a secret army in 147 countries.
We're listening to excerpts from The Coming War on China, the new documentary from veteran journalist John Pilger. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm joined in studio by our producer, Anthony Fest. You know, some parts of this documentary are not about China per se, but they focus on U.S. military activities in the Pacific. And we were just hearing more about that. John Pilger also goes on about nuclear weapons tests on Pacific Islands. We've covered that story here on the Project Censored before on the Marshall Islands and elsewhere. So much in this couple hours with John Pilger, The Coming War on China. So much that we think people in the United States need to hear, should hear. But if you have a steady diet of junk food news and corporate media run by six corporations, 90% of your diet is not important information that you need to understand what's going on in the 21st century. 800-439-5732 gets you one step closer to getting this film, Coming War on China. When you call 800-439-5732, $100 gets you this great brand new DVD. Be the first on the block to have it. You know, John Pilger, when we interviewed him last week, quipped that it's interesting that this movie was even being shown in YouTube on China. And he had to ask them to take it down so maybe they could negotiate some other ways to show it there. But yet, you know, you're not in much danger of seeing this movie here in the United States. You'd have to seek it out far and wide to try to find a copy of this in the United States. But we're handing it to you for your generous pledge of $100 to support Free Speech Radio, to support the Project Censored Show. $100, Coming War on China, John Pilger. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. $120 gets you Censored 2017. That's our 40th anniversary edition that I put together with Andy Lee Roth and the great team at Project Censored. You can learn more about that at projectcensored.org. You can learn more about John Pilger at johnpilger.com. You can get the combo, the book, the movie, $200. But what you get is you get the peace of mind knowing that you're supporting information integrity. You're supporting getting this kind of information out there by keeping the lights on at KPFA. 800-439-5732. A special thanks to an anonymous donor in the East Bay who just gave us a fantastically generous donation. So thank you, and thank you for everyone that's been calling in during the hour. Keep the calls coming. Thank you, Mara V, down in Boulder Creek. Thank you for your call. Thank you for supporting the Project Censored Show, Free Speech Radio. 800-439-5732, the number to call.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Jim White, How to Respond to Climate Change Deniers. When the Weather and Climate Summit was established in 1985, the goal was to bring together weathercasters and meteorologists from the US and Canada with scientists and researchers. Their annual summit of 2017 was held in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12. One of the many topics at the summit was to prepare for the incoming Trump administration that includes outspoken climate change deniers. Dr. Jim White teaches at the University of Colorado. He specializes in global change, paleoclimate dynamics, and the human impact on climate. In a very entertaining and easy-to-understand way, he addressed the five topics climate change deniers most often bring up. How can we insignificant humans change the climate? How can something like CO2 that is in such low concentrations have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? We've seen about 1 degree of warming. Why worry about such a small change? I heard there was no warming recently for several years. Does that prove climate change isn't happening? Dr. Jim White began with the question, are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? Here is Dr. Jim White, director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado.
Welcome, everybody. I would like to begin with a little exercise that I've been doing. I give public lectures about the topics of sustainability and resilience and climate change, et cetera, at least a couple of times a month. And I started to give a little demonstration I thought I'd share with you. It goes like this. And I do this for a while. And so what I'm doing here is I'm demonstrating for you the two primary types of behavior. One of them is, we understand as physics, right? So every time I drop this, this pen's going to fall, right? And I can drop this pen all day, every day, for the rest of my life, and it will fall every time. It will never stop in mid-fall and just hang up. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that the universe, as we understand it, is governed by physical laws, and those physical laws are not breakable. So gravity is something that happens, and it happens all the time. And as scientists, we understand that. The other behavior that I'm demonstrating here is free will. I can stop doing this whenever I want. I can stop being annoying whenever I want. I choose... I am choosing not to do that.
Anytime, Jim. Anytime.
Anytime, anytime.
All right, I'll talk.
I do an entire lecture on this. We get confused about this sometimes. We get confused about those things that we can control, like free will, like stopping this pen dropping exercise, and those things that we cannot control. So we cannot, for example, control gravity. We cannot control the fact that molecules vibrate, and if molecules vibrate and you give them the right energy, they'll absorb that energy. And of course, I'm talking about, you know, greenhouse gases absorbing energy in the atmosphere. That's going to happen regardless of what we do, regardless of what we say, regardless of what we believe, regardless of what we would like to see happen. And that's an important distinction. Many people who don't understand science get those things confused. They get them mixed up. What are the things that I can believe in that I can actually have free will about? And what are those things that I really don't even get an opportunity to believe in? Because they're going to happen whether I believe in them or not. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to continue on. I've given many lectures here at this conference. So this year I thought I would frame my conversation around the top five questions I get asked at public talks. Right? And they are... Number one, are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? I get this question a lot. How can we insignificant humans change the entire planet's climate? Another question I get asked quite frequently. Number three, how can something like CO2 that is in such low concentration have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? Number four, we've seen about a degree of warming. Why worry about such a small change? In other words, is 1 degree something that we should care about? As inhabitants of the planet. And number five, and we've heard this frequently recently, I've heard that there's been no warming for several years. Does that prove that climate change is not happening? All right, I'll take you through these. Are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? The short answer here is no. We're not pushing the climate system out of the bounds that have been observed in the past when life was present on the planet. Now, the better answer here is more nuanced, and it's more nuanced because climate has changed quite a bit on the planet over the years, while life has been present, but not all life. And I'm talking now about species extinctions. So species have gone extinct frequently on the planet, and many of those extinctions we know are related to climate change, and particularly rapid climate changes. Going back about 40 million years ago, the planet was about 4 degrees warmer. CO2 levels, by the way, so CO2 is a hard thing to reconstruct that far back in the past. The ice core record, which goes back about 1 million years, can give us direct parcels of the atmosphere that we can measure CO2 in. But once we get beyond that time, then we're into a variety of things here. You see how many stomata are on leaves, phytoplankton, paleosols, liverworts, believe it or not, boron isotopes, things like that. And so you see, we think that the CO2 levels as you go back in the past were in the neighborhood of 500 to 1,000 parts per million if you get far enough back in time. All right? So this is another important lesson. We have enough carbon locked up in coal, oil, and natural gas to raise CO2 levels to at least 1,000 ppm. But that's not a level that the planet has never seen. Right? That's a level the planet has seen before. Now, this is where the nuanced answer comes in. There have been major extinctions on the planet, the end of the Cretaceous, the end of the Triassic, the end of the Permian. Now, these are mass extinctions. There are as many as 30, 40, 50% of all species going extinct in a relatively short period of time. Currently, we're in an extinction. This is primarily driven today not by climate change, but by the fact that we are changing the surface of the planet. We are taking away habitat by building towns and villages and shopping malls and everything else that we build. We fragment migrational pathways. We do things to species that make it difficult for them to exist. Some species are going extinct because of climate change today, particularly those that are at the more sensitive zones. So high-altitude species, Arctic species, where their habitats are changing quite a bit, are the species that we're seeing today that are being forced into extinction by a changing climate system. So, are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? The better answer is no and yes. Climate change is a poor way to wipe out all life. And if you wanted to figure out how to wipe out all life, we can talk about that. There are ways to do it. We have the tools and the techniques. But yes, we are eliminating habitat and forcing species into extinction. And yes, climate change, especially large abrupt climate change, causes extinctions. It's important to recognize that in changing the energy in the climate system, we are indeed causing some species to go extinct, and we'll cause more and more of them to go extinct. And that is not a good way to hang into the planet. All right, question number two. How can we insignificant humans change the planet's climate? And the answer to this one is even more important, and that is that we are not insignificant. This is a misconception that some people have. We, as a matter of fact, in one short generation, our generation, we went from really kind of a passenger on spaceship Earth, if you will. If you go back to the 1960s, as we used to tell us, we're passengers on spaceship Earth. We're no longer passengers. We're in the driver's seat. We're not only in the driver's seat, but we shoved a lot of the other people off the bus. We move 10 times more dirt than all natural erosive processes. If you add up all the dirt that flows through all the rivers and streams and blows through the atmosphere as dust every year, and you get a big number, and then you compare that to the amount of dirt we move in mining operations alone, it's 10 times more. You can do this. You can go on Google Maps and you can look at coal mines in the western United States. You can find coal mines in Wyoming that you can easily see from outer space. Right? So these are very large holes in the ground. We've talked about this before also in the past. We make more nitrogen fertilizer than all bacteria on land. If you want to have life on a planet, you need to have, particularly the kind of life that we have, you need to have photosynthesis, and photosynthesis requires sunlight, it requires CO2, it requires water, and it requires nutrients. And those nutrients are generally nitrogen and phosphorus, but some smaller nutrients as well. So we really couldn't have plant life until we had nitrogen nutrients. And nitrogen nutrients are produced by bacteria. Bacteria take nitrogen out of the atmosphere, and as part of their energy strategy to survive, one of their waste products is ammonia or nitrate. And ammonia, nitrate, are water-soluble forms of nitrogen, which then plants can take up and build DNA and other molecules that we have in our bodies and that plants have in their tissues and that we need those things. So life on this planet really couldn't exist without those bacteria. We figured out in the 1930s how to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere, because it's very abundant, and make it into nitrate and ammonia. And today, we make more nitrate and ammonia than all the bacteria on land, which is pretty freaking remarkable thing to say, because in really one short generation, we went from not being part of one of the key systems on the planet to where we dominate that key system. And we have to. I mean, we could talk about more about this, but if we're going to feed 7 billion people, we've got to make nitrogen nutrients, because that's the way our agricultural systems function. We have to do that. And the scale with which we do that is the point I'm trying to make here. It's a recent development. This is population going back to about 10,000 years ago to today. It doesn't really show up as a large number until about 2,000 years ago. We're at 7.4 billion people today. It took about for when we started as a species to the early 1800s to get that first billion. It took about 120 years to get the second billion, then 33 years, and then 14 years and 13 years. And that's the exponential is a remarkable thing. Population demographers told us this was coming, but we really didn't digest this very well in terms of planning for the future. Another example of an impressive human-caused change that's already occurring and has occurred for quite some time now is something called dead zones. So I talked to you about all these nitrogen nutrients. When we fertilize our farmlands, some of these excess nutrients run down the rivers. They go into the estuaries and then out into the, in this case, the Gulf of Mexico, or they go in the Atlantic, etc. And those excess nutrients cause phytoplankton to like go crazy. They love this stuff. It's like, you know, buffet is on. It's like, all right, time to eat. They eat like crazy, and then they die. When they die, their body parts have to decay, and when they decay, they suck all the oxygen out of the water. And so you end up with this water that cannot support oxygen-needing life. And this has been happening for a long time. There's huge swaths of the Gulf of Mexico, huge swaths of the Atlantic coast as well, that nothing lives in, at least for part of the year. And because it's water, as you know, it's moving around, and so that dead zone moves around and kills off a few things and other things move in. But the fact that we can do that is another example of how human beings are really not insignificant on the planet. Water, we use pretty much all the available surface water in developed countries. So in Europe and in the United States, in many years in the United States, we use 100% of the available surface fresh water. And as you know, it gets used over and over again. We also pump groundwater in order to get through droughts. And we're learning that groundwater supplies are depleting very rapidly. And so there's a day of reckoning coming there. And again, if you think about it, all right, is a small species capable of pumping groundwater to the point where you're exhausting it in many parts of the world? No. I mean, this is clearly a species that has a huge impact. All right, so the bottom line is we're not insignificant with respect to the planet's capacity to support us. To think otherwise will delay action that is needed to achieve sustainable, resilient human societies. This ought to be a T-shirt in much, much fewer words, but it ought to be a T-shirt. Okay, number three. How can something like CO2 that is in such low concentration have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? Right? Shorter answer is that things that come in small sizes have big impacts. Right? We know this, right? If you look at the radiative balance of the planet on the large scale, the Earth's temperature without greenhouse gases, without these small amounts of gases in the atmosphere, would be about negative 18 degrees C. We know this. We have satellites at the top of the atmosphere that tell us this is how much solar energy we're getting. And if we were just a rock in outer space with no atmosphere, we would be about negative 18 degrees C on average. And most people would argue that's too cold for advanced life. We couldn't exist as we are on the planet. Now, the Earth's temperature with thermometers taken out there is about 15 degrees. And the difference between negative 18 and plus 15, about 33 degrees C, is the impact of these very small amounts of gases that are in the atmosphere, these greenhouse gases. They raise the temperature of the planet by a large amount. Okay, and that's a good thing. Right? So if we didn't have greenhouse, we need to recognize that. If we didn't have greenhouse gases, we would not be a liquid planet. We would be a frozen planet. So when I get this question about how can something that's 400 parts per million make a difference, we'll talk about water. All right? So water, the average percentage of water vapor in the atmosphere over the U.S. is about 1%. You've got crops. You've got plants. You've got precipitation. You've got, you know, wonderful, lovely green things that exist because of 1%. Right? Again, when I get that question, how can something at 400 parts per million make a big difference? Well, how can something at 1% totally change the surface of North America? And the answer is small things have big impacts. Isn't CO2 good for plants? And the answer is yes. As I pointed out before, plants need CO2, they need sunlight, they need water, and they need nutrients to grow. All right. So, if you give plants more of any of those things, will they do better? And the answer is generally yes. Biologists tell us there are limiting factors. So, for example, if there's no nitrogen available, it doesn't matter how much water you give a plant, it's going to die. Right. So, but if there's enough of these things around and you add more, then you're going to get a boost in plant growth. So imagine the sun was heating up, for example. We had a much hotter sun. giving the plants many, many more photons to do photosynthesis. Would they grow more? The answer is likely yes. Right? We can do that. You can take plants into a greenhouse and give them artificial sunlight, and they'll do better. Now, would it become unbearably hot? And the answer is yes, it would become unbearably hot. Right? The important thing to recognize here is that, you know, good things always in moderation. And we hear this quite a bit. This is Jeff Sessions here. Carbon pollution is CO2, and that's not really a pollutant. That's plant food, yes. And it doesn't harm anybody, except it might include a little temperature increase, yes. All right. Does it really harm anybody? Yeah, as a matter of fact, yeah. So, again, good things in moderation. Now, plants are growing more. Right? This is one of the more remarkable observations that we have today. Here you see the sources of carbon from 2006 to 2015. It's 91% from fossil fuels, 9% from deforestation. And on the right is a partitioning of where that stuff is gone. And this is one of the things that I do in my research. I use carbon isotopes and other things to try to figure out. We know how much stayed in the atmosphere. We can measure that. How much of that went into land plants versus how much goes into the ocean, we can actually figure that partitioning out using something called carbon 13. But from 2006 to 2015, about 31% of the carbon that we put in the atmosphere is now in land plants. It has increased the amount of land biomass that's out there. About 26% of it dissolved in the ocean. And the ocean would like to run the show, and so the ocean is going to take in some of that. And then about 44% of it's still in the atmosphere. All right. So is CO2 plant food? Yes. Have plants been growing more? Yes. All right. Despite deforestation, there is more biomass on the planet today than there was in the 1800s, which is pretty remarkable. Because if you follow deforestation, we are deforesting today, and we have deforested since we started out as a species. And there's definitely less large forests, particularly in tropical areas today, than there has been at any time because of us. Now, it's important to recognize that we can't grow our way out of the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. And the reason I can say that with confidence is that there is way more carbon in coal, oil, and natural gas than there is in all living biomass on the planet. All right, so if we wanted to grow plants to remove all carbon dioxide, we would have to have not only this planet, but we're going to have to rent two or three other planets in order to make that happen. We simply don't have enough biomass. We don't have enough land surface. And at the same time, we also compete with land plants for the land surface. We need land surface to grow crops. And that means you don't have space for trees to grow that you would have otherwise. And so, no, you can't grow your way out of this. Okay, number four. We've seen about 1 degree C of warming. Why worry about such a small change? And this is one of the more important questions, I think. And I really like it when I get this question. I think it shows that people are thinking about this, you know. 1 degree, is that really significant? Is that really important? All right, so let's take a look at what 1 degree means. So we think that during the various interglacial periods that existed, about 120,000, 140,000, 240,000, et cetera, roughly every 100,000 years in the past, we think it was warmer during many of those, including the last one. And we have fairly good records accessing the last interglacial period. We think it was about 2 degrees C warmer at that time. Now, that's helpful because I'll loop back and I'll show you what are some of the key metrics in terms of how the planet looked with 2 degrees of warming. I would point out, by the way, so 2 degrees is not a number that I'm just pulling out of my head. 2 degrees is what, you know, right now the global leaders are arguing over whether or not we can achieve a plateau at 2 degrees. And some people are saying, no, it's got to be 1.5. So 2 is an important number here. If you go back about 3 to 5 million years ago, you'll find the planet was warmer at that time by about 2 degrees. This is fairly well documented. This is ocean bugs that live out there that record temperature, and 5 million years is quite accessible in the ocean sediment record. So we're pretty confident that if you go back 4 or 5 million years ago, you get temperatures about 2 degrees warmer. By the way, 3 to 5 million years ago, CO2 levels were about 400 parts per million. If you go back farther in time, you'll find that if you go back about 40 million years, the planet was about 4 degrees warmer than today. That's a significant point in Earth's history because Antarctica started roughly at that point in time. So if you go back about 40 million years, and that's when the planet cooled off enough that Antarctica started. So is 2 degrees significant? And the short answer is yes. Right? It was about 2 degrees warmer in the last interglacial period. Sea level was about 5 meters higher at that point. Right? 5 meters higher at 2 degrees. That was about 1,000 years of warmer time. Right? So keep in mind that it takes a while to melt ice, and we'll talk about that in a minute. It was about 4 degrees warmer when the Antarctic ice sheet did not exist, and sea level was about 80 meters higher at that point. So there's about, between Antarctica and Greenland, there's about 80 meters of sea level that's been taken out of the ocean and put down as land ice in Antarctica and Greenland. And that's an important lesson for, again, you know, those of us who look at deep Earth's history, this is like no big deal. Yeah, constantly we have sea level rising or falling and land ice doing the opposite. That's just the way the planet functions. But for many people, the idea that sea level could be 80 meters higher, you know, when you actually look at the maps, is like, this is one of those holy shit moments. In the last 40 million years, the full range of temperature change has been about 10 degrees C. That includes no ice sheets, and that includes large glaciations. So, no, 2 is not insignificant. 2 is a decent part of 10. Right? If you take away the glacial side of that, which is about 6 degrees, it got 6 degrees colder during the last glacial period. The warming that we've seen over the last 40 million years was about 4 degrees. Right? And we saw huge changes on the surface of the planet that accompanied that 4 degrees. So no, 2 degrees is not insignificant, and 1 degree is not insignificant. Right? I've heard there's been no warming for several years. Does that prove climate change is not happening? No. Physics still applies, right? Global climate depends on 3 factors. We know this. How much energy we get from the sun, that's physics. How much of that energy is reflected back to outer space by the white bits, physics. And the amount of greenhouse gas, which is controlled by molecular vibrations, again, physics. Right? So if you increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you will change the amount of energy in the atmosphere, and you will change, therefore, the climate on the planet, because the climate on the planet is indeed the energy in the atmosphere. Our focus tends to be on air temperatures because we live in the atmosphere. The ocean community thinks we're pretty, you know, selfish, and you know, the fish out there, you know, they get together occasionally and say bad things about us. But the fact is, you know, 90-something percent of the heat capacity at the surface of the Earth is in the oceans. Ocean heat content has been increasing. And the reason for that is that as you accumulate greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you accumulate energy in the atmosphere. As you accumulate energy in the atmosphere, it has to go someplace. And it can go to evaporation. It can go to temperature. If it's going to go to temperature, it's going to warm the ocean up. And if we got a good accounting of how the ocean is behaving, you'll see that this keeps going up over time. So the atmosphere temperature is really the tail. It's the ocean that's the dog. And we need to pay attention to the ocean. And you can see on there, yes, indeed, the atmospheric temperatures slowed down their growth. And that's what you expect. You expect that on a planet that is 70% ocean. When you have times in which cold water is circulating up to the surface, it air conditions the atmosphere. When you have times when deep ocean is not being allowed up to the surface, the surface ocean warms up very quickly, and you end up with a much warmer planet. This is what a phenomenon of El Nino and La Nina, all right? So we know this. There will be times when atmospheric temperatures bounce around a little bit, but they are the 7-8% of the heat capacity. If you really want to understand what the planet is doing, you need to understand the ocean. Part of the message of change is that it takes a generation or two for, you know, what we put in the atmosphere to have its full impact on the planet, because it takes a while to warm up the ocean. We argue about when did the Anthropocene start? When did human beings really reach a point where they were the number one thing on the planet? It's really in the 1980s where the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere really begins to shoot up. The warming, particularly that followed that time, we can't attribute to anything but the increase in greenhouse gases, which are a human-caused thing.
That was Dr. Jim White. director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. He spoke at the annual conference of the Weather and Climate Summit before meteorologists and TV and radio weathercasters. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017. Dr. White was preparing the audience, and now you as well, for challenges by climate change deniers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Because if you destroy all alternatives, and you destroy the standards by which people can judge your behavior as being completely wrong and unacceptable, then you kind of have carte blanche in a sense.
That's the voice of author Stephen Newcomb. On this week's show, we speak to Stephen about his book Pagans in the Promised Land. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged this morning to have author Stephen Newcomb. He is the author of Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery. Very honored to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Now, we've been talking about the implication of colonization and the kind of apartheid, well, not kind of, the apartheid system that has been created where indigenous people are guided by one set of rules and other people have other set of rules that grants them rights to their lands. In your book, you lead us through an understanding of how the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, has a deep connection to the way we see the world today. Can you tell us what inspired you to write this book and why is this the Old Testament so significant to the colonizing process that takes place today?
What inspired me to write the book was my investigation of United States federal Indian law and international law and particularly a early Supreme Court decision of the United States called Johnson versus McIntosh, which had to do with the question about the nature of land titles in the United States. And when I began reading that decision, when I was taking a federal Indian law course in college many, many years ago, I noticed that there was language in the decision about Christian people and natives who were heathens, which is, of course, non-Christians, and that the Supreme Court used that phrasing, Christian people or Christian prince or people, several times, and they even put italics under those words, Christian people. So I began to investigate that, look, that early connection, and I also, in my mind, connected that language and that ruling with a book by an eminent American Indian scholar named Vine Deloria Jr. In a book called God is Red, he wrote about a Vatican document from 1493, which is called the Inter Soterra Papal Bull, or it's a particular type of document, papal bull. And in it, that particular document called for the subjugation or domination of what were called barbarous nations in that document. So I started putting all these elements together, and I've been doing so for three decades now. And what I found in my investigation is this way in which the narrative of the Old Testament, the idea of a chosen people having the right to take over a land assigned to them by a particular deity or God, that they somehow, on the basis of that understanding of themselves, began to engage in imperial enterprises of taking over other people's lands and properties and resources. And so I traced that narrative right into the federal Indian law system and saw that that was actually what provides the background frame of reference for the Supreme Court decisions and the decisions in places like Canada and other places in the world like South Africa and during its time of apartheid and so forth. So this is a global phenomenon that's been ongoing, and somewhat, I mean, a starting point we could talk about is the what's called the era of discovery. And the idea of discovery is to locate lands that have not yet been placed under that form of dominion or domination that the so-called chosen people carry with them in their minds.
Well, we assume under the current capitalist model that the land is simply a commodity that can be exploited and plundered, the same metaphor can be applied to the way peoples have been treated and languages have been dismissed. So in your book, you make very clear connections to the importance of language and the ways we see the world. So take us through the metaphors of Adam and Eve and the creation story. Why is this story so significant to the current colonial rule?
The starting point of that particular oral history, what it began as an oral history, it's now a written narrative, but how that began is with a particular command to the two beings said to be created by that deity in the Old Testament. And that particular commandment is found in Genesis 1:28. That's the real significance of the story as I see it. And that particular commandment, just to paraphrase, it says to subdue the earth and exercise dominion over all living things. When you trace those words in Hebrew and you trace them in different throughout their linguistic history, what you find is they both are simply synonyms for domination. So basically it's a command to dominate the earth, and you can't dominate the earth where places are already inhabited by distinct nations and peoples unless you also dominate those peoples already living there. So this is the basic fundamental element that informs everything that follows after that. And that's why that particular story is so significant. And then you go into, as I do in the book, you go into the idea that Abraham, who became Abraham, was guided by a particular deity to leave his father's country and to go to a land that deity would show him. And when they got to that place, then the Abraham was instructed to look out, and this was all the lands that were going to be given to him if he decided to enter into a covenant with that particular deity. So then you go flash forward to passages in the book of Deuteronomy, for example, Deuteronomy 20, verses 10 through 18. And in one part of that, it says, to save alive nothing that breathes, as the Lord your God has commanded you, meaning that genocide is completely acceptable. In fact, it's even commanded by that particular deity. So these are very problematic themes, and when you look at the relationship between, as you said, the metaphors, the root metaphors and the root concepts that result in behavior and social patterns and institutions, what you end up with over a long period of time is the social construction of domination, and that works through language and through behavior and so forth. But it's not seen. It's completely below the surface of awareness for many people, but of course for indigenous nations and peoples on the receiving end of it, it's not invisible at all.
Your book, I love the way you've organized it, because it leads us through also another stage that takes place, and that is this rationality versus the sensuous way of looking at the world. So we have the rational thinking, the Western way of looking at everything from our mind, you know, as the mind being superior and creating all kinds of hierarchies, in many ways capricious and arbitrary, that create a hierarchy of what's a better process, right? So this idea of the law being what lays down the barriers or the guidelines of how society should be organized, have significance not just in the way the lands are today, you know, partial and redistributed to mining companies, which are unceded, unconquered territory. Can you speak to this?
The main point about that, in terms of everything I've already stated, is the idea that if you're a non-Christian people, and if Christians locate your lands, they assume unto themselves the right to grant your land to others. And they may say that they're acknowledging some form of title in you based on your prior existence there, but it's always inferior to their now newly claimed form of title, which is based upon a root concept of dominion or sovereignty or domination, as I call it. The flip side of that word domination is dehumanization. But they consider that to be completely rational, because meaning the outsiders, the foreigners that are invading, consider their behavior of granting your lands away to others to be completely rational. And they base that on the idea that you're not civilized, and that evidence of that is the fact that you're not Christian. When you look up the word civilization in the dictionary, at least in my huge Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, it gives a particular definition, which is the act of civilizing, especially the forcing of a particular cultural pattern on a population to whom it is foreign. And so the forcing is the key or the clue that this is actually a pattern of domination. So the forcing of a cultural pattern of domination on a people to whom, peoples that are independent of that, is considered to be a rational way of behaving toward life, because they say that they're creating order out of chaos, and that's part of their rational process. But behind it all is really just the economic motive of greed and being able to grab resources and making it sound very plausible to themselves.
When we think about the ways that our society understands this sort of legitimacy of the rule of law, and yet, as you point out, without looking at how from the beginning, you know, the law is committed to uphold, at least in Canada, you know, the Queen's mandate or whatever. There's this colonial sequence that today continues, right? And so whether it's whether you go to the Supreme Court, they're already commanded to follow a particular set of rules to benefit those who have entrenched themselves in control power. But I want to talk a little bit about this conqueror model that you speak about in the book, because to most people, the idea of using the Bible as one excuse for domination may seem simplistic. And for others who are perhaps Christians, they may reject this outright and say, oh, that's ridiculous. Can we talk about the implications that this has had as a society? Because to me, the way of life, an ethic of coexistence that most indigenous cultures share, whether you look at Algonquin people, Anishinaabe people, whether you see the Little Wet people, or it doesn't matter where you go in the world, indigenous people carry within their cultures a history of coexistence, of interconnectedness to the land. I wonder if you would like to speak to the significance that this has as a society and that dehumanizing process that takes place when we separate ourselves from our original, you know, where we all come from, whether we want to recognize it or not. We all are sustained by the land. We are all sustained by Mother Nature.
One part of that is the misuse of language, in my view, at least from an indigenous people's perspective, to talk about the law. There are two letters missing from the word the, and the letters are IR to create the word there, meaning their law. And saying it's the law makes it seem universal and universally applicable to all peoples and even those that have predated the existence of any of these colonial models for extended periods of time, thousands of years. So what I go back to is our original free and independent existence, and that's our starting point. And when you go back to that, then you go back to our origin stories. And in none of those origin stories that I know of, none that I have ever found, do you find a commandment of domination. You find stories about relations and beneficial relations and how the elements of creation came into existence and how they're to operate in a way that maintains their existence for all time. And so it's a completely different orientation toward life. It isn't one of hierarchy and domination and dehumanization and lording it over others. It's certainly within North America, it's based upon these other models, such as the seven laws of the Anishinaabe or the seven laws of the Oglala Lakota Nation, and the different systems, the condolence ceremony of the Haudenosaunee and so forth. We could point to many different models, and those have been discounted and dismissed, and actually the dominating society has deprived itself of the benefit of thousands and thousands of years of cultural and social and psychological and other forms of evolution engaged in by indigenous peoples to create these these what are now we consider alternative systems, only because they're alternative to the system of domination. So this is the way in which I look at things, to say that domination and dehumanization are unsustainable. And you see the effects of domination when you look at the tar sands and you look at all these different ways in which the waterways, the water systems of the earth have been contaminated, and just look at all the different examples of the destruction of nature and the destruction of natural processes and ecosystems, and you see that it's an unsustainable way of life, and it's becoming more and more evident all the time. But the indigenous systems have been sustained here for thousands of years before the invaders arrived, and those are still viable models if they're allowed to flourish and thrive once again. And one last thing is that the use of the residential schools and the boarding schools to actually kill indigenous languages, to engage in a process of linguicide, which is the intentional killing of the language, that process was designed to intentionally destroy any alternatives to the domination dehumanization model, or what I call in the book the conqueror model. Because if you destroy all alternatives, and you destroy the standards by which people can judge your behavior as being completely wrong and unacceptable, then you kind of have carte blanche in a sense.
I love that you make that connection so clear, because when we look at the process of removing children here in Canada, that continues today, by the way, the residential schools have closed.
Yes.
But we still have that process in place. I was saying that to me is like removing all the birds from the forest, you know, removing all the song and the laughter. And not only that, but it's removing the seeds, you know, that will generate the vibrancy and the continuity of that language, of that culture. So how do we create, you know, rebuild, because in essence, for most of us, it's a process of remembering and recalling who we are, having been displaced and removed from our, you know, from our lands, from the places where we belong. How do we remember? How do we go back and reclaim what has been lost?
There are many different ways to do it. Ceremony is one, to the extent that people have access to ceremony. Visiting and engaging with elders is another. There are just many, many different ways to do that. But the first thing that's necessary is the desire and the intention to do so. And that desire and that intention is there, and it's becoming more visible. I'll give you an example. If you go to Pine Ridge Reservation today, you see purification lodges, which are sometimes called sweat lodges, and you see sun dances and so forth. I mean, just thriving. And so it is, you see the language to some extent being revitalized and people working on that and seeing the need to do that. So it's a decolonization process and it's a liberation process. And it just is something that we all have to find the various means of doing that in our own particular ways. And there's probably no one particular example or guide, because it's going to be completely varied from region to region. But the thing is that what I realize is that we need to awaken to the destructive patterns that are being used, and oftentimes we're not aware of how those patterns are operating. So I'll give you an example of the way in which the English language continues to maintain certain patterns, and we're not aware of them. For example, the word mortgage is actually two Latin words, mort for death and gage for grip. And if we were to say, I have to pay my death grip this month, but I don't know where I'm going to come up with the money, that you're having financial difficulties, it would be so much more clear what we're actually talking about, and in terms of the banking system and so forth. So there are ways in which we break apart English language and learn to decode the language that's been used for purposes of manipulation, then because we have awakened to that, we're less likely to be manipulated by that. Another key example is found in one of the Vatican Table Bulls of the 15th century, and there's a sentence that reads, "We trust in him," with a capital H on him, "from whom empires and governments and all good things proceed." But when you look up the Latin version of the document and you look at the word governments, how does that translate in Latin? It turns out that it's the word dominationes, dominations. So they're referring to a deity out of whom they believe empires and dominations and all good things proceed. But the point I'm making is that the word governments in that context is actually dominations. And so one of those is a domination, and that's the domination model of government.
In closing, I like your comments on this model of rights versus responsibility. Throughout Avyayala, there is no word for rights, but there is among all indigenous people, whether Incas, Aymara, there's a sense of responsibility. You know, not just to yourself and to your community, to the land, but to the generations that comes after. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. It is interesting that when you go into the metaphors of English, the word rights actually goes back to the idea of a path and the right of rule, so regula, regere, to lead straight or to a straight edge. And So it's the idea of creating lines that everyone has to stay within. And but with the responsibilities, it's a completely different cultural form of understanding, which is what are the relations between forms of life and how can they be sustained for all time. And that's what our traditional systems have understood, and we cannot carry out our responsibilities to our traditional territories and our waters and so forth if others are creating encroachments within our territories and creating hierarchical dominating systems that destroy the very basis of the fabric of life. So it's a really a huge conflict between these different perspectives and worldviews, and it will play out as it does, but we will continue unwaveringly in support of our responsibilities to our places and our traditional territories and our languages, ceremonies, and so forth.
Thank you so much for joining us. My guest is Stephen Newcomb. You are the law researcher coordinator for the Sikuan Band of Kumeya. And could you tell...
Yeah, Kumeya Nation.
Uh-huh. Kumeya Nation. Could you please tell our audience how they can reach your book, Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery, and how can they access your work?
Well, I do write columns for Indian Country Today Media Network. So if they type in Indian Country Today, they'll and put in my name in the archives, they'll find my last name, Newcomb. They'll come up with many columns, over 200 columns written over the last decade or so. And then my book is available on Amazon.com. It's probably the easiest way to get it, or you could request the bookstore to order it. And also we have an organization that my friend Virgil Kilstrate, who's Oglala Lakota, found, and I founded back in 1992. If you type in Indigenous Law Institute in the internet and hit enter, it'll come right up to that link and you can go right to it. And we have a fair amount of writings there as well. And it explains our mission, statement and so forth. So. Yeah, those are some of the ways that folks could reach out to me, and we have and my email address is available on that website for Indigenous Law Institute.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real honor.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations, and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.